world gone insane. An upside-down civilization cannot be real. A world of madness and terror.
It's the Dana Gould Hour.
Today's show is brought to you by Casper. Get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/Dana and using the promo code Dana. Welcome to another episode of the Dana Gould Hour, recorded partially in Los Angeles at Falcon's Lair Recording Studios and partially in beautiful Atlanta, Georgia, where I am for the summer filming season 2 of Stand Against Evil. And unlike last year, we will not miss an episode of the podcast. We are locked, cocked, and ready to rock. Two amazing and hilarious guests today, Brant Tobler, a comedian and author whose new book, Free Roll, is available now. He has a life story that, dare I say it, rivals anyone's I've ever met. And an old friend of the show and one of the funniest people I know, the hilarious Matt Bronger. Me? I am not back on tour until July, where I'm doing something down at Comic-Con, and I'll tell you about that next month, and lots of other stuff. That'll happen. Stand Against Evil and my new album are both coming in the fall. But all that aside, let us now take time to do our filthy business.
Tune in, it's a gas. It's the Dana Gould Hour podcast.
It's showtime.
My guest tonight on a crisp, windy, cool Los Angeles evening, high atop the Mulholland View shelf, where tonight specifically the streets are filled with coyotes, because it's not even garbage. Normally they come out on garbage night, but tonight is just a spooky night. My dog's freaking out. There are coyotes everywhere. It's a full moon. That might have something to do with it. My guest is a very, very talented comedian who I just worked with, and I did not know you before, and started telling me about his life, and I said, holy shit, you have to write that as a book, and he said, I just finished. That book has just come out. It is called Free Roll, and our guest is the author, Brant Tobler.
This is the sound of my voice.
Now, Brant, when I was a young man, I read On the Road by Jack Kerouac, which is sort of a rite of passage for anybody who's 20. And everybody has that fantasy of just kind of kicking around and letting life happen to them. I was never able to do that. I was born clutching a to-do list. But if you did not intend for that to be your life, you seem to have created that life for yourself, at least up through the events of this book.
Yeah, it's I guess it just kind of happened. I didn't realize until I was about halfway through, like, this is going to be my life. I'm the opposite. I know to-do lists. I just kind of go, and that's worked out good. It worked out well sometimes, and also it's been a disaster.
Yeah, and the book sort of tells the story of both. Just as sort of a tease, at one point in the course of this story, you gave serious consideration to having your father killed.
Yeah.
Okay, so stay listening, everybody.
Yeah, it'll pick up, trust me. So yeah, I grew up in a small town in Wyoming. And it's just not much there. A little, you know, cowboy town.
Right.
Lived, you know, a lot of people
Cheyenne?
Have ranches. Cheyenne.
Not
Dad Kill Wyoming?
No, no, not not anything that would ever get me prepare me for my life.
Uh-huh. So now, what goes on in Cheyenne? Is it
not much?
Is it a lot of rich people? Isn't Harrison? Doesn't Han Solo live there?
No, that's all up in Jackson Hole, which is about as far away from where I'm. Cheyenne, where I grew up, is about 100 miles north of Denver.
Oh, okay.
It's just a small little town full of railroaders. And
Dick Cheney lived there?
Cheney's Casper.
Oh, okay.
A little north. There's nothing really
nothing
in Cheyenne. We have the largest outdoor rodeo. That's its claim to fame that they do every year in the summer.
Okay.
So just pretty basic growing up. Well, I didn't realize. I thought it was basic. So my dad was a railroader, him and his father and his uncle. But then he became a drug dealer.
Now, what do you mean by railroader?
He was like a train conductor. They all worked on the Union Pacific Railroad.
Really?
That was their job, yeah. And that's how.
Now, your father was a train conductor.
Yeah. Well, he worked on the railroad.
Did he give you good and plenties? Was that a big part of your childhood?
No, I wish. Because I'm a big fan. So he was.
He gave you neither good nor plenty, yeah. Actually.
So he was a railroader, and then he became a drug dealer and a bookie out of the local strip club, and then
now what is the that's not a natural progression.
Yeah.
You do your time on the railroad and then you can move into drug dealing and running numbers.
Yeah, which is like
what's the strip club? Let's get right to the hoof of the matter. What's the strip club like in Cheyenne?
The strip club, it's my favorite strip club, but there is nothing like it. It's called the Green Door, and there's a stage about as big as a picnic table. There's no pole. There is looks just like a towel rack that you would see that hangs from the roof. That is the most stable.
I can't imagine a strip club being sad, but Lord knows that's the vision I'm getting.
The most incredible towel rack I've seen hold incredible amounts of weights. It's just welded to the roof, and it literally just looks like a towel rack out of your bathroom, and I've seen women hang from it, and it is very sad because so after each girl comes off stage, there's no DJ. They have to put their own quarters in the jukebox and then come Windex the windows.
Oh, geez.
And it gets really cold, so a lot of times they're in bikinis and tube socks, and they're on this little it's one of the – you begin to embrace it when you live there. It's the ultimate dive.
And you must know all of the – I mean, there's no one
– Yeah.
You see them at the laundromat, I'm assuming.
They're commuting in
from 500 miles away.
But when a new girl comes in, everybody knows. But it's famous for it had a one-legged stripper for a long time and a girl with a huge bear tattoo on her ass that she thought was hilarious. And
the same person?
No, different one.
Oh, because it would be great if the bear was positioned as if it had just finished eating her leg.
Yeah, that would have been perfect. So somehow and it's weird because a railroad, that's one of the best jobs you could have in Cheyenne, and it's a job that everybody wants. So I don't know how.
Not hanging off a towel rack down at the old Green Door.
Yeah. So, and the building, the Green Door itself, I mean, it's like it's about as big as a bedroom. I mean, it's a small, small bar. It's probably 35 people max in there. Jeez. So if you ever go through town, you should definitely stop. But, so he got into that and then he was just an awful.
But here's my fear of stopping at the Green Door in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Somehow I'm driving I'm driving, and I've noticed as I'm driving, it's been nighttime for 4 days.
Yeah.
And I pull into Cheyenne, Wyoming, and I go into the Green Door, and the one-legged stripper's there. And I have a beer, and I get up, and I walk out the door, and I find myself back inside.
Yeah.
And that continues for eternity. That's my fear.
Yeah, that's a lot of people in Cheyenne have done. So somehow
I just left.
Yeah. So he got into selling drugs. We started doing drugs and he got into selling drugs. And then he was.
And how old are you at this point? And how old's your dad?
My dad's probably 24, 25. And I'm, this is from the ages of like birth to 3 or 4. And then
you're doing drugs at 3 and 4?
No, I'm not. My mom and him are doing drugs. Okay. And he had a big champagne and cocaine party. That was his thing he'd have every morning, and all his buddies
every morning.
Yeah,
every morning.
So they would show up, and then so eventually, and he was just bad, beat my mom all the time, and my mom just couldn't take it anymore. And then one day, like, walked to the, because he would always, so he was cheating on my mom all the time, and then my mom found out, and then he moved us to Fort Collins, Colorado, so no one could tell on him anymore. And then he would commute to Cheyenne, but then we had no home phone or we had no car. So we were just stuck at this house.
And how far is Fort Collins from Cheyenne?
About 50 miles south, okay, between Cheyenne and Denver.
So he literally just like moved. He didn't move. He just isolated you.
So he could do whatever he wanted again.
Right.
And then so eventually, and then
he just put his life on lock.
Yeah. So then he eventually, and then he would just beat the shit out of my mom. She couldn't take it anymore. And then one day, you know, he beat her up pretty bad. And she was like, and she's very anti-violence and gun. And she said she woke up and she was laying next to him. And she's just like, if I had a gun, I would kill this motherfucker right now. And that scared her because she's never had feelings like that. So then the next time he beat her up, then he left. And then we walked through the snow to like a grocery store. And she saw this like battered woman sign there and she just knew she had to get there, and she got there and called, and they came and picked us up, and then we went to Wyoming, and then my dad came home and found out we were gone and went crazy trying to find us and ended up wrecking his car, crashed into like four cars and flipped over and landed on top of another car. His like Cadillac landed on top of another car, and he was in jail, and my mom assumed he'd come to Cheyenne to try to get us.
Okay, let's slow down.
Yeah.
So let's assume that he comes home. And he's full of something, probably not Wheaties.
Yeah.
He's probably jacked up on something. Yeah. Comes home, his family's gone. He goes ballistic. He's driving a caddy.
Yeah.
And he literally just starts driving around Fort Collins, Colorado, looking for you guys.
Yeah, we assume.
Yeah.
And then all we know is that his mother
and then he has a Blues Brothers Aryan car accident.
Yeah, and then so we're in Wyoming at my grandparents' house, and then his mom calls my mom and says that he won't talk to anyone but my mom, and my mom's like, I'm done talking to him. So she quit talking to him, and then maybe 8 months later he got arrested for bringing drugs across state lines, and
okay.
he went to prison in Leavenworth, Kansas. So at that point,
it's a famous prison.
Yeah, my mom. So then
he's a young man. He's in his late 20s, right?
So then my mom, she told us that he went to college. So we were under the, and then I think my mom said it because my mom told us.
But you knew who he was.
No, we didn't know anything. I didn't know any. I mean, I knew my dad, but this was all up.
So you're how old at this point?
Five.
So you don't even know that there's abuse in the house?
No, I didn't know.
Okay.
I thought my dad was like this perfect guy.
Sure.
So then,
oh, that's different. Okay, so you didn't even know that your dad.
No, my mom kept it all from us.
Right, that's a heavy burden.
I thought he was in college. That's what my mom would say, and then he would get out every couple of years, and he'd come visit us on his spring break. They would call it. So then we would see him occasionally, but we didn't know anything. We thought our dad was actually at college doing like good stuff, and he would call, you know, once a week, and we would hear from him. So then, my mom. So then when it got really bad...
Did he send you photos of like him in a giant, like oversized fur coat with a pennant?
No. He sent us like license plates and stuff, like stuff like that.
Yeah.
We couldn't send him
stuff. I'm majoring in giving people a tattoo with a pen and a lighter.
Yeah. Like we made... When I was in second grade, we made these boxers. You did like a pastel. You like painted boxers to give to your father for Father's Day.
Right.
Some that said like, I love my daddy. Or what? I love my dad, I think it was. And then my mom later in life told me, yeah, we didn't get to send those to him. They probably wouldn't have gone over too good at his college.
It's kind of a gray, overcast day here above Mulholland Drive in the Hollywood Hills here at Falcon's Lair Recording Studios. I'm joined by one of my favorite guests here on the show. A good friend, a funny comic, one of the members of the Dana Gouldauer family. If I was Carol Burnett, dare I say, this is the Harvey Korman.
Yes, I'll take it.
When I think of Pepitone, I think Vicki Lawrence.
Yes, without a doubt.
And poor Lyle Wagner. Who would be Lyle Wagner? Anyway, Matt Bronger is here.
Thanks for having me, man. Always fun. Anytime you say the Falcon...
Falcon's Lair recording.
Falcon's Lair. I always think of the Eagle's Nest, like Hitler's house.
Yes. Well,
and I to the point where I listened to your podcast religiously, and I had to kind of like at a red light Google like wasn't the Falcon's Lair?
No.
Okay.
Falcon's Lair, I believe, was Errol Flynn's house.
Oh.
Not too far from here. It was called Falcon Lair.
All right.
But where Falcon's Lair comes from is David Anthony Higgins, who you might remember from Malcolm in the Middle. He was Jane Kara's Merrick's friend from work.
Yes.
He's the brother of Steve Higgins from Jimmy Fallon.
Yeah.
Dave had this shitty apartment in North Hollywood, like a, just like the cottage cheese ceiling and everything. And we would play cards there, and he called it Falcon's Lair.
Nice.
Just because it was just this, I mean.
But anyway, you know, giving a hovel, like your first, when Kyle Kinane and I first moved to LA, we called our little shitty apartment, the Royal House of Lords.
Exactly.
Or the R-hole.
The R-hole?
R-H-O-L. Yeah, we even came this close to having like signage, paintings of ourselves, you know, like each framed. Some people come, because we used to have like random little parties. We would be like, oh, are you? Oh, they're gay. Oh, this is their married picture with them.
It's just in bathrobes, red and blue bathrobes. Brian Kiley, who's a really funny comic and a writer on Conan,
used
to have a joke in his stand-up years ago from Boston, which was, the shittier your car, the greater the odds it would have a name. Like, you know, if you had like a 1972 Dart, how's the car? You mean the cruising vessel?
Yeah, that's perfect.
What was your first car?
What my first car was actually the Ford Escort that I bought for my mom and drove from Portland to LA after I left Chicago.
Because
all through college, I lived on this tiny little campus, and you'd take a train into New York. And in Chicago, if you own a car in Chicago, you're making a mistake.
Yeah, same with Manhattan. I was like, why in the name of God would you have a car here?
Yeah, I always felt like traffic in LA is akin to parking spaces in Chicago. You know, like just as glutted, just nightmarish. As yeah.
Yeah. I had a 1973 Duster.
Wow.
3x-the-knee, slant 6 engine. And I just remember being in, backing out of my parents' backyard. My brother was driving it. I was in the passenger seat. I was my older brother, so I can't even drive my own car.
Sure.
It's like, he's my older brother, so he has to drive.
Mm-hmm.
He's not paying attention. Slams into a tree. It just turns, like, not like a car, but like, dents the front.
Yeah.
And he just looks at me and goes, first dents the hardest. That's... That was the end of it.
And I have a particular affection for any time someone does something, quite obviously their fault, and then it's just like, well, that happened. You're like, hey, what are you going to...
Who's the sportscaster with the mustache that was caught?
Pat O'Brien. Yes.
Okay. They're at some giant golf thing. Golf is a whole world.
Yeah, of course.
That I have no... affiliation with it all, yeah. And they're at some big golf tournament, like at the table with all the sportscasters and stuff and all the high-end people of the tournament. This couple years ago. And Pat O'Brien comes by and he goes, hey, how you guys doing? Hey, how you doing, Pat? He goes, yeah, I had a really good night. Got in late last night. Saw Tiger. We went out, had a drink. It was a really good night. Guy goes, you were with Tiger last night? I was with Tiger last night. And he goes, caught me in a lie.
No! No. I love the immediate dismount. Well, there went that moment.
Dismount. Got me in a line.
Oh, my God. That...
have you heard the Lenny Bruce bit about when your wife catches you cheating? Like, she goes,
yeah.
Your wife will catch you in bed with a chicken. What are you talking about?
Huh? Yeah. I'm from like a group of ne'er-do-wells in Chicago, like that I started out with. That once, if someone called us on our shit right away, okay, you're right, and it would blow people's minds. Like, Kyle and my buddy CJ Sullivan were up at like 3 a.m. blasting Faster Pussycat or some heavy metal, you know, thing, and someone's like, turn that shit off at 3 a.m. They turn it right off. You're right. And you know the guys in the room, like, oh my God, that worked.
Oh, that was easy.
I lost my temper horribly. I was in a friend's apartment, you know, those apartment buildings we have in LA where it's just surrounding places and a swimming pool in the middle
that everyone just uses. Courtyard. Right.
Yeah, and people are jumping off the balcony to thing. Yeah. And, you know,
they're very depressing places to live.
Oh, God. And I'm just, you know, jumping in the pool and stuff. And this guy, and we're all drinking beers, and this guy comes out and he's just like, he's like, it's 2 a.m. You know, like, you get out of there or something. And I was like, I stopped. I was like, you're right, man. You're right. And the guy's staring at me like, are you are you fucking with, are you? I'm like, no, I'm completely sincere. This is out of hand. We shouldn't be doing this. And he's like, well,
thank you.
Thank you. And went back in his apartment and we cleaned up and we left.
when I was a kid caught in a lie, usually when my ex-wife would catch me in a lie, I was like, you know, you said you were going over to Rob's house, but Rob's with Jill. I just was on the phone with him. No, you want to know where I am? I'll tell you where I was. Tell you where I am right now. If that's what you want. Is that what this is? An exchange of information?
Just stretching it out. Oh, think.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God.
Here it comes. Here comes the truth right now. I'm going to tell you.
I'm picturing Pat O'Brien going, caught me in the lie.
Yeah, just tell
me. And then that kind of, that explosion of way too much laughter, and he kind of slaps his pocket, and a still too full bag of cocaine flops onto the table among all those rich guys. Oh, whoops.
Oh, gosh. Caught me in a lie.
Caught me in a lie.
Well, yeah, that would be great. It's like when life becomes an episode of Perry Mason, when the person just tells it immediately.
Yes.
Which, by the way, never happens in real life.
No.
Ever. You know, don't you also own a VW Bug? Yes, I murdered her. Whoa, whoa, hey, whoa.
Oh, my God.
Whoa.
And I'll tell you why.
What's the thing, bad?
Like, it's a thing where I feel like
people have stood up in the courtroom. People in the back. No, I didn't.
Yeah.
But you said that the kite was blue.
I killed him. Who is that? Every one of those is a mistrial.
Meanwhile, Berger just crumpling his notes. God damn it.
Hamilton Berger.
Again. We got you this time, Perry. That's every episode of Perry Mason. We got you this time. Well, I beg to differ by the end. You lost again, Berger.
Berger, how are you still working?
How are you? How many cases? You're the worst DAs this city's ever had.
Hamilton.
Bob Sarlat, brilliant comedian in San Francisco. One of my favorite jokes. There are those jokes that are just a straight line.
Yes, yes.
The king of it is
no fat.
Norm MacDonald is the king of it. My favorite Norm MacDonald joke, I'm paraphrasing the joke, but was the city of San Diego today announced plans for a floating runway for the airport. It is a runway that extends into the bay and floats on pontoons. It's all a part of the city's plans to have a huge disaster. And Sarlat used to do this joke back in the 90s when I was living in San Francisco. I was like, hey, have you seen these Perry Mason TV movies? Hey, I don't know what Raymond Burr's been doing lately, but I don't think sit-ups is high on the list.
I'd like to call Sarah Lee to the stand.
As a witness?
No, for some cakes, pies, and cookies.
I love the sweaty. As a witness?
Like, that has to be said. Because the guy was like, wait a minute. And that kind of, that gives a background as if he, fatter Perry Mason, yeah, keeps calling people for snacks. Okay, witnesses.
I'd like to recall Duncan.
Your Honor, this is out of hand.
Dolly Madison. I'm calling Duncan Hines to the stand.
I'd like to call Famous Amos to the stand, please.
This is a murder.
Everything is food in his head.
Yes.
Burger's like, I'd like to call a sidebar. Candy bar? It's not what I said.
I'd like to call Sarah Lee to the stand.
It's the simplest human foibles. I remember Kyle used to kill me all the time. And anytime, like, there was an extremely pregnant woman, and he would just go, ugh, I'm stuffed. Like, she just eat, she just, that's all food. She just had like 10 omelets. And it was so dumb. And it was, you know, nothing to do with her being pregnant.
Sure, of course.
Just the image of someone with that big of a stomach.
And the rest is
not fat. So it's like, that's the cartoon. You ate a whole turkey, and now you're trying to escape.
So
So then my dad, he'd come visit us a lot. And then when he'd come to town, he would just show up and he was a drug dealer again. So he'd just come and buy us a bunch of stuff and spoil us to make up for not being there. So we just thought he was like the best guy in the world.
Right.
So then he ended up having to go back to college, prison. And
he had to go back to – he loved education is what you're saying. He was dedicated to his education.
So then at that point, he started promising us – he couldn't buy us stuff and he started promising us all this stuff. So when he wouldn't show up, he'd buy us a bunch of stuff and send us these UPS packages.
Right.
But then when he went back to prison, instead of just – they kept with the story of telling us he was at college, but my dad kept promising us all these gifts. So then my mom would go buy all the stuff my dad promised and go like a mile from our house and UPS the package. And then we'd
run. My God, she's a saint.
So we'd run home and we'd get our package and my mom and step. So at this time, my mom has started dating someone else and we marry and we have a stepdad. And so they're buying these packages from
my dad. Was your stepdad a college graduate?
He was an actual college graduate.
Exactly. So that must have really burned his burned his ass.
I'm sure.
Oh yeah, no, he's a college.
Yeah. So they were spending their, you know, so then they'd have to buy like double presents and then they
And you just, have a brother?
Yeah, a little brother. So they just couldn't afford it. So they eventually told my dad, "Hey, quit promising the kids stuff." And my dad, just being an asshole, just promised more and more. So then eventually my mom just,
he sounds like a winner.
My mom just couldn't afford to do it anymore, so she stopped covering for him.
And you're how old now?
So now I'm at this point we're probably 11 and 9.
Mm-hmm.
And then
are you still in Fort Collins?
No, we're back in
Wyoming.
So then my dad would call and I would say, "Dad, where's our package?" And instead of telling us, he would be like, "It must be lost or something." So then I would say, "Mom, can you call UPS and try to find it?" And my mom would say, you know, she'd try to cover. And then eventually, after it wasn't there for like a month, and I think they were frustrated, they're like, "We don't think the package is coming." But my dad never lied to me, so I had no reason to believe that. So then I call my dad and say, "Hey, the packages aren't coming." And this is one of the lowest moments with my dad. He, instead of just manning up and saying that, he tells me that he thinks that the UPS man is taking our packages and giving them to his kids. to his kids. So me and my brother at that point are...
Can I just...
Yeah, of course.
I love just the naked, unrelenting amorality of the entire endeavor. There are times when you think like, I don't even have to lie in this situation. Oh my God, I don't have to lie. I can just tell the truth.
Yeah, which would have been much better because then that sent us in a spiral. So I believe my dad. Yeah. I had no reason to not believe him.
It's very important
we came up.
Your kids don't think you lie to them.
So we came up with this crazy plan. So at one point... to kill the UPS man. Because when my dad came to town one year on his little spring break...
So how is he getting out of prison?
So he'd get out of prison. So he got out of Leavenworth and then he would get back in trouble. He couldn't stay out of trouble. So I think he was in Leavenworth like 2.5-3 years from like 5 to 8, then he'd get out, then he'd go back in, then he'd get out.
Right.
So we got to see him. So I think when I was...
Recidivism, I believe it's called.
So I was 10 or 11 and he came to town, my little brother's 8 or 9, and he took us swimming at the local pool. And we swam and we had a great day jumping off the diving board and everything. And when we got out of the pool, I'm taking a shower and my father comes in as I'm showering. He goes, "Hold on, son, get out of the water for a second." I was like, "All right, what's up, Dad?" And he says, "Son, every time you take a shower from now on, before you get in the shower, put the water on as cold as it can go, and then get in that cold water and shadow box until you count to 15. And I was like, "Why would I do that, Dad?" And my dad says, "Son, the way your body reacts when the cold water hits it is the same it'll react if you ever get stabbed. So if you ever get stabbed, you'll be able to fight for 15 seconds. So my dad tells us, because I guess that's what he did every day in prison.
"People,
to train.
Let me tell you about my best friend."
So we, and like a dumbass, I did that shit because my dad told me to. So then when we heard that UPS thing, we were like, "We're ready for this moment." We're like, "We'll go get, if we show up at his house." So we went up to, there was an Owl Inn, a restaurant up the street from my house, and we went.
Now, do you have to get stabbed in the shower?
There's no logic to any of it. So we were being dumb kids. We rode our bikes up to the Owl Inn, the restaurant, and we stole 2 steak knives, and we recruited 2 other neighborhood kids to come with us, and we were going to follow the UPS man to his house to see if his kids had our toys. So... Sure enough, the day that we decided to do it, you know, we can't do it on Thursday.
I'm assuming you're okay that I laugh at
this. Of course, it's all funny to me now. But, you know, and then like, so we were going to do it Thursday, but then our buddy Eric had a dentist appointment, so we had
to do it Friday.
So we wait for the brown truck to come.
Knives on ice.
Yeah, and we're, so we're,
Big Brown.
So now we're riding our bikes, the truck comes, we start following the truck, which of course is just a, we have steak knives, jumping curbs with steak knives, like so dangerous alone. But we follow the UPS guy, which is easy because he stops every couple blocks. We follow him his whole route. He gets back to the headquarters, then of course just parks his bus, or his truck, gets out, locks it up, gets in a green Jeep, drives away. We immediately lose him. He loses us in like two blocks and he doesn't have to stop every block. So thank God, because we weren't ready to go to college at that age, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So then after that, so not long after that, my mom, now I get to be, I'm 12. This was like probably when I was like 11. And so when I'm 12, my mom.
Your UPS man stabbing days are over.
We throw the steak knives in the lake because we saw that on like movies when you kill somebody, you gotta get rid of the evidence, even though we didn't do anything but steal a steak knife. So then my mom sits me down when I'm 12, my little brother's 10, and she brings me in a room and she says, I want to tell you something. She hands me this manila folder and I open it up and it's all the newspaper clippings from when my dad got arrested. Mm-hmm. So I read them and I'm confused, you know, and she's like, I know this is a lot and we lied to you and your dad will call tonight if you have any questions. He wants to talk to you. So I was all upset and I went out to, we had a treehouse. I went out in the treehouse. I'm just crying. I'm confused because I didn't know. And my stepdad comes out. Luckily, I had a great stepdad. So that night, my dad calls. And I have all these questions, but my dad's like throwing a fit. And he just keeps saying, you're a Tobler son, you're my son. And what I didn't know is that my mom and stepdad had told my dad that my stepdad was going to adopt, he wanted to adopt us. But my macho dad, of course, threw a fit and said, you're a Tobler, you'll always be a Tobler. So then,
gee, thanks.
So yeah, so we didn't know. So they set us down that night after we got, and he didn't
and he did he, let me ask you a question. Did your mom just tell, like, all right, I can tell the kids now?
Yeah.
And he didn't have, I mean, he was in prison, so yeah, he was so in college.
Then, so yeah, he called.
What's he going to do, come home from college?
He called collect that night like he always did. And that's the funny thing is, so then they sat us down and they said, hey, you know, and my stepdad was like, I would like to adopt you guys. I feel like I'm your son. I raised you. And they're like, no hurry. You guys think about this. Mm-hmm. And I'm 12, my little brother's 10. We didn't really know. We loved our stepdad, but we loved our dad.
Sure.
And this all hit us fast. So then, of course, my dad found
out. What was worse to you? Knowing that your dad was in prison? Or knowing that he lied to you for all that time?
Just prison. Because I had just done the D.A.R.E. program in sixth grade. Mm-hmm. And they're just, back then they didn't say the difference between like black tar heroin and weed. It was just like, if you do drugs, you're going to die or you're going to go to prison. So the fact that my dad was in prison, like, it blew my mind. So then my dad started calling the house every day threatening to kill my stepdad, which I think is hilarious because they would collect calls and my stepdad had to pay for his own death threats.
He's quite a hello, Arthur.
I think my stepdad was like, hey, can you keep it short since this is like $7 a minute? So then eventually
I'll accept. I'm going to kill you, motherfucker. Would you like to continue? Yes, continue. Yeah.
So then eventually my dad sent his friends to the house to actually threaten my stepdad. So then we decided that it wasn't a good idea. And my mom just said, let's just not do this at this point, which I always say is the best thing that ever happened to me, because even though my stepdad was a wonderful person, is a wonderful person, if I would have got adopted by my stepdad, I would have started junior high school as Brant Huffendick.
Wow.
At 12 years old, I thought was the worst name in the world. I was
His
like,
name is actually Huffendick?
My poor little sister's named Haley Huffendick. And I can't believe she didn't get married at midnight when she turned 18, but she had to live with that her whole.
What's her middle name?
Haley Elise Huffendick.
Why not just change it into Haley Elise? Yeah, well, what's your last name, Elise?
She's been tortured by it. So
if my name was Dana Huffendick, I would change my name to Haley Elise. Yeah.
So
that's a brutal one.
That's the only thing my dad's ever
done. Now, wait a minute. Let me just think of this. People who worked in iron smelting got the name Smith. And people who made barrels are named Cooper.
Yeah.
Huffendick. We talk about like caught me in a lie. At a party, I knew my friend's wife was pregnant. Oh. I asked her when she was due, and she'd already had the children.
Oh.
And it was just like shitting your pants. And and there was nothing. And it was just nothing. One of the worst moments of my life.
Yeah.
And she didn't play it well.
Oh.
I already had the baby.
Oh.
just like looked awful. I was like,
probably had like, you know, I didn't like even, a bit of postpartum.
Of course, yeah. Know. And I didn't have the facility. It so stepped on a rake.
Yeah.
That I didn't even have the, like, now I go like, oh, boy or girl, like immediately get off track. Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, sure, sure.
Like just, that didn't happen. Mm-mm. That didn't happen.
Yeah.
No. I heard this story. Things are just like, and then I have to go back to Big Fat Perry Mason.
Yeah, of course. We have to get to his island at some point.
We have to get to his island. We have to get to his suits. And don't forget the SS Burr is what it's called. Okay. So Paul McCartney has a house in Los Angeles. And all of his friends, you know, he's friends with every like giant musician who lives here. You know, it's like.
Of course.
And most of them are big studio guys, like, yeah. You know, Jim Keltner and all these guys that are on every album ever made.
Well, and he supposedly is this guy who's just, like, he's like, what's that that baseball position where you can play any position on the field?
He can do anything. Yeah.
Every musician who's played with him has been like, he plays every instrument perfectly and knows every song.
Yes, yes.
He'd be like, oh, that off your album that just came out. Oh, the third song? Here we go. What? You heard that one. Like, he's kind of got that Mozart thing going. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Yeah, and he plays drums on a lot of the latter Beatles albums. It's him on drums. And when he was married to Heather Mills, the one-legged Scottish woman who nobody liked.
Right.
His friends didn't like her. And their derisive nickname for Heather was Peg.
Oh. They keep accidentally throwing on the Steely Dan song?
It's
huh?
What?
What? I just like this song, Heather.
So they're at a club here in Los Angeles. And they're in the back, and there's a bunch of people like Leonard Cohen and Jim Keltner and all these people talking to Paul McCartney.
Yeah, yeah.
And the waitress finds an Yves Saint Laurent handbag in their booth. So she comes back to where they're talking in the kitchen and says to, like, I think it's like Jim Keltner, one of these guys, like or Larry Nechtel. You know, one of these guys has been on every record.
I've yeah, yeah, sure.
I found a bag in the booth. And he goes, that's probably Peg's. No, it just goes, excuse me, Peg.
Oh.
Peg, is this your bag? And it's like a dozen people agree that it didn't happen.
Right.
It was just like, nah, it didn't happen.
Nope. Mm-mm.
Nope, didn't happen.
Oh, my God. Yeah, when someone, one of my friends in college kind of had the best analogy for, you know, why, I mean, not that there anyone who, with any sense knows why. There doesn't know this, but like, you know, why white people can't use the N-word friendly way as black people will oftentimes do with each other.
Yeah.
And he was just like, you know, it's like if you grew up in a neighborhood and everyone just called you asshole, but these were your friends and it was your nickname. And then someone new comes to the neighborhood and calls you asshole. And you're like, you can't call me that.
Yeah,
and I'm
exactly.
like, okay. Yeah. You know,
and I love when like indignant white people go like, oh, so you can say it and I can't.
Yeah.
Yes. That's exactly right.
They took it back.
That's exactly
deal
right.
Deal with it.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah. That's exactly it.
Yeah. You don't get to do a thing. Yeah.
It was just happening with the health. So why do I have to pay for somebody else's health care?
Oh, my God.
Because that's how insurance works.
That's what insurance is.
That's the nature
that's
of insurance.
That's what it is, you child. Yeah. Yeah. Everyone is literally Lenny from The Simpsons. Can't someone else do it? Everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to. For the same reason we all pay to have a big red truck come when our house is on fire.
Right. Yeah.
I don't want to pay for that.
Yeah.
I can't.
Why won't cops work for free?
I know. So who do you think? How do these people come to your house?
These highly underpaid public servants.
When my when I was a kid, we'd be driving through our hometown and or any town, and we'd see a big fat person walking on the street. My dad would always go, "Keep walking."
Oh.
Which brings us back to Raymond Burr.
Yes.
Because I don't want to get away from Raymond Burr.
Sure, no.
So, apparently, Raymond Burr's nickname was, I think, I just wish I lived in the late, well, I lived in the late 60s, but I wish I was like an adult here in the late 60s.
Oh, sure.
Apparently, Paul Lynn coined Raymond Burr's nickname, the Iron Duchess.
Oh, that's perfect.
Yeah.
That's utterly, utterly perfect. See, I would want to live in that era just so I could get a nickname for Paul Lynde. Just go to a party. It's 3 p.m. He's on his ninth martini.
Yeah.
And then he just calls you a thing, and it sticks forever.
Supposedly, Paul Lynde and Johnny Carson were the two meanest drunks on earth.
Oh, God. Yeah. I could see that.
Yeah.
You know? But like Paul Lind had an excuse.
Yeah, you know? He's full of self-loathing.
Well, and gay. Yeah, and yeah, just bitchy, so much hatred around him.
Angry, bitchy queen.
Oh, God. Yeah. You know? And imagine you're basically like America's gay mascot. No one's going to give you any kind of credit for your identity and who right. you are. Certainly not sexually. But you're just, oh, you're saying ribald things,
well,
you know.
It was this thing when you were a kid that when you were a kid, you didn't think, like, I didn't realize there were gay people. Just there were guys on game shows that wore ascots.
Yes.
It's like Charles Nelson Reilly, Paul Lynn, Roddy McDowell. There were just these guys uh-huh. that did gay. There were these guys on Match Game that wore scarves.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
was just like a confirmed bachelor.
Confirmed bachelor.
Confirmed bachelor.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Tab Hunter.
That was
confirmed
it.
Bachelor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that really was, that was like the blatant code.
Oh, like, yeah.
Confirmed for bachelor.
Sure. For sure.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
And Perry had an island of.
Yeah. It, like
Raymond had an island of confirmed bachelors.
Yeah. It was like a tropical boy garden, I think is how you would describe it.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, Arthur Clarke, who wrote 2001, had lived on an island in Sri Lanka that was like immune from international boy laws.
Oh, no.
and I think Raymond Burr, this is probably getting into legal problem, but I think he had kind of the same deal. I'm sure everyone was of age and consenting.
Of course. But, of course.
It goes without saying.
Well, like when I was in the Philippines 2 years ago with my girlfriend, we're in this little island called Bontian, and it's beautiful. And these little like kind of like woodland bars, and they were like real bars, but they were just kind of like all kind of these tropical things. And you'd see these guys, you'd see like dad boners, like, you know, Mike Burns' Twitter character dad boner, Carl Wilzine, who's a man who's divorced his family so he can party. He like grew like
wait a
ponytail.
Wait a minute.
He got a book deal out of it.
I don't know anything about the, what is this?
Okay. Name? It's at Dad Boner, and it's a guy named Carl Wilzine who parties. Like basically the pattern will go on Thursday, he'll tweet, really looking forward to the weekend, you guys. And then Friday, took a couple hours off from work to really get the weekend going. I need, you know, like got to burn off some steam. These Crown and Diets are going down so smooth, and then you won't hear from him for 3 days. And then it'll start then really hurting you guys. And then the whole day, he'll just tweet, what happened? And he lives in Grand Blanc, Michigan, and he will drive his car, he'll tow his boat to the parking lot of a bar and like party in the boat. Like he's an exaggeration of every man who cannot let go.
Yeah.
Of that. So, and I was in the Philippines. I kept seeing dad boners. I kept seeing guys in their like 40s and 50s.
Oh, yeah.
Hair and ponytails way too fat.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I met.
As George Meyer put it best, which was, I never associated the Hawaiian shirt with the word snug.
Yeah. Yeah. We do like a big trip every year. And like last year we were in the Bahamas and I met Doug. And Doug is a rich man who he and his wife hate their children. And, you know, my gal and I, we party. We're no slouches, but we're out on this kind of boat cruise. And Doug is they're giving us these rum coolers that are like you two sips. You're like, whoa, okay, I gotta slow down. I'm feeling way too happy about myself. Doug is slamming them. And every time I saw Doug throughout the weekend, he was drunk and somehow wet. I don't know if he woke up in the ocean. I don't know.
Up swimming.
Gray hair. Always college drunk. Come up and high-five me way too hard. Like he found out I had a special on Netflix, and he'd see me and go, this guy's a fucking assassin. He'd just yell that over and over. And he'd high-five me. And at one point, his wife was...
That's awful.
And he's one of those guys that liquidates companies' assets. He's like a parasite for corporations.
Oh, worst. Yeah.
And his wife was, we were talking to her, you know, Doug had run off onto the beach because I think he saw a professional football player he wanted to accost. And so the wife is with me and Kara. Yeah. And is like, and she's like, oh, well, we're having the best time. And we're like, oh, how many kids do you have? Three. Are they with you? Oh, hell no. Oh, fuck no. Her words. Like, Jesus, you really hate your kids. You see your kids as a job to run from.
Yeah.
And they were saying, like, what are your plans? Well, we have dinner plans, but with the way Doug drinks, I don't know if we'll make it. Like, it's the weather. You know, it's back to what we were saying about the thing of just like, yeah, the first dent's always the hardest, buddy.
Yeah, that's it.
Damn it. You did this. You could stop doing this.
Yeah. First dent's the hardest.
First dent's the hardest. That's what it is. Yeah. And it just, I mean, and oh, we went to, there's, last thing I'll say about it, there's this place called Elvis's Bar, which is just a boat on the beach. This guy's converted into a bar, and it's awesome. And it's like,
it has the Bahamas?
Little, yeah, uh-huh, and it's these little, these little seats, you sit, you know, onto the boat, and there's a guy in the middle, and full bar, and it's called Elvis's Bar. It's this tall, skinny black man that looks nothing like Elvis Presley or Costello, but that's just his name.
Yeah, not
his
name. Not Elvis, not tall, not skinny,
nope,
not black.
None of them. And
so it's actually perfect.
It's perfect. Yeah. And they're like, oh, we went to Elvis's last night. Doug thought he'd hit one of the locals' joints, and he promptly showed us 15 pictures of Doug asleep on a hunk of wood. People posing around him, posing like they're all putting their legs up on him, like girls, like Doug. And he's just, he's asleep, like if you just walked up to someone and you pulled back their bed sheet.
How old a man is Doug?
I want to say at least mid to late 40s.
Okay, so like not like old, but like
no.
But an adult.
But yeah, an adult.
Three kids.
Adult. Three kids.
Yeah.
We didn't go into his family tree, but I dodged that bullet. Luckily,
you need 23 in me.
Yeah. Well, of course, later in life, then much later, which will I'll just give you a little heads up later. Of course, when he steals my identity and now
no, let's just get to
okay, that. Well, yeah. So then after that moment, after we dodge the Huff and Dick thing, then he just disappears pretty much. I don't hear, so from like 12 to 20, I don't hear from him. Mm-hmm. I get phone calls.
So he threatens to kill your stepfather because he doesn't want him to adopt you, but he's gone.
Yeah, I would get like cards, but a lot of times they would come from my grandparents. It was obvious, which was kind of like insulting our intelligence, like, oh man, my dad's penmanship sure got better at college. Like, I can tell the difference on my 16th birthday.
According to this postcard, Dad can't wait to go antiquing.
Yeah. So then he just disappeared. You know, he'd always say he's going to show up for my graduation, and I would, in the beginning, I'd believe he'd actually show up. But by the time like my high school graduation and all that, they'd be like, my grandma would say, no, I think your dad's going to make it. I'd be like, get out of here. I don't give a shit anymore. I'm not looking in the stands anymore waiting for my dad to show up. I'm not falling for that.
No, and it is, you know, a therapist would say he was an addict and his addiction ruled his life and he was powerless to change. But then you also get to, and they're just bad dudes.
Yeah, yeah. Just the word. I mean, and we're barely even, we're not even to the bad stuff yet.
Yeah.
And he's bad right now.
Yeah. So, and it is interesting because you always like look at like, well, Manson's mom pimped him out as a kid. You know, yeah it's terrible stories, but and to me, it's the way you treat your children is like the third rail.
Yeah.
It's like if you're an asshole to people around you and whatever, it's great. But when you are shitty to your kids, that's when I go, no, there's something wrong with you.
Yeah, no, I agree.
It's there is a biological imperative, if nothing else.
Yeah.
It's like food, clothing, shelter, care for your young. It's like, you know, it's like, and if that wiring is fucked up, then yeah, there's something deeply amiss.
Yeah. And the thing was, I had a great childhood. So, like, even though my dad wasn't around, that did, but I by no means was.
Well, there's like, you know, it's a storybook childhood. Remember the movie E.T. with the kids on the bikes with knives, trying to kill a mailman.
People were like, oh my god, you had it so bad. But I really, because the small town took care of me. Everybody knew who my dad was,
right?
So I had great coaches and teachers, and everyone
steps up.
I always had it, and my stepdad was great. So I didn't have like a really rough childhood. As like I did, my dad wasn't around, but I was fine actually. As far as like, it would bother me when. Then it just got to the point, like, just quit telling me he's going to come because he's not.
Right.
It's just, I'm doing great. I don't need this shit.
Right.
So then I graduate from, I graduate high school and I didn't know what I was going to do. And I was just lost. I was bad at school. And then I ran this. So I got a job in the mall Mm-hmm. These four Italian brothers from New Jersey moved to Wyoming.
Now that right there sounds like
open up a pizza parlor. Now I'm not saying witness protection, but
yeah,
we.
What else is it?
Yeah,
but would they open up a pizza parlor? I mean, it's that sounds too good.
Yeah,
that sounds too good.
Yeah, but it's the truth. And they came and they were. I mean, they had a shotgun in the freezer. We had like 16 cameras in the pizza parlor.
Oh, maybe they.
And they were selling Coke as a topping. Like they were selling Coke in the mall. They eventually got busted for it. So this was my first job. And then it's a place called Parkway Pizza. It's still there. That's incredible.
Famously,
pizza.
Where Hillary Clinton is also running people eat kids in the basement. Now I don't think it's witness protection. Now I think they fucked up.
Yeah.
And they said, get the fuck out of here. Like, we're going to try to crack Wyoming. Great. Yeah. Good luck.
So they come, and then their father's there. So every Sunday, they had a little Italian father. He'd come in these incredible suits, and he would talk to him just in Italian. And I didn't know Italian or anything.
It sounds very organized.
So I was fascinated by him. And then I was like, I want to be in the mob. I want to be in the mafia.
Yeah.
Because I just thought these guys were so cool.
I get it. Yeah.
So I watched mafia movies, read mafia books, and then eventually they fired me because I was rooting for America versus Italy in the World Cup.
So
I was late a couple of times. It was just bullshit. I got fired. So I got a job next door at a place called Sports Fan, which is a sports store. And I worked there for about 2 months, and they were just assholes to me every single day.
The pizza guys?
No, my job. It's pizza. They were so cool. They'd give me free pizza and shit. But the Sports Fan dudes were mean to me. They were just shitty to their employees. So I was like, I took all my mafia knowledge and I started what I called the Malfia. So this is how the Malfia worked. Like if you worked at the taco place, you gave me tacos, I gave you a hat. You worked at Foot Locker, you gave me shoes, I give you a jersey. You work at Sears, you give me like a TV, I'll give you whatever you want.
That's how it works too, by the way.
So I had the Malfia running so strong that I could get anything in the mall except for puppies or jewelry. And then there was these Mormons that owned.
Well, this is that scene in The Godfather, no puppies.
Yeah.
They're animals. Let them have puppies. Yeah.
So, and then there was these Mormons on the cinnamon roll place, and they weren't conforming to this.
Oh, those fucking Mormons.
So I was running it, and it was cool. I was like,
did you lean on the Mormons?
Nah, I said, whatever. They were shitty cinnamon rolls.
Woke up and Mitt Romney's head in their bed.
Yeah. So I'm running this Malfia, and I'm like the king of the mall. I'm walking around like I'm John Gotti or something.
You're like 15?
No, at this time point, I'm like 19.
Same
so
thing.
Then same I, thing. I hook up this girl across the way. She wants a hat for her dad for Father's Day. So I trade for some boxers. Like one of the most smallest trades I did, the most minimal thing. She gets a conscience. She snitches on me. So I'm
cherchez la femme, right. Man. Cherchez la femme.
So my bosses come to me. It's December 20th. And they say, hey, we know you've been giving away all our stuff. So we're going to fire you, but you're not technically fired till the 27th because we don't have time to hire someone new and train them for the Christmas rush to do the returns. So in my head, I'm like...
Fear and loathing at the Cheyenne Mall.
So in my head, I'm like, holy shit, everyone's going to have the best Christmas ever. So now
those guys are idiots.
I'm hooking up everybody.
How stupid are those guys?
So like little kids would come and I'd give them hats and stuff and they'd run out so happy. And then I realized you couldn't do that because then, you know, 10 minutes later, a dad would stomp in with their little kid and be like, hey, why does my kid have a new hat? And I'm like, because I'm like Malfia Santa. He's like, you're like a fucking pedophile. Quit giving my kid shit.
Yeah,
and I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm
bad.
Sorry.
Yeah, now it looks bad.
So I got to hook up a couple single moms, which was cool. You know, I told them I had an employee discount because I knew they wouldn't, if they knew I was just stealing shit from them. I was like, I get like 75% off, and then I would just ring it up and I'd hook them up. So then the 27th came.
So they got, when you say hook up some single moms, you mean
I gave
you
them.
You gave them some stuff for their children.
I gave them as much.
That means something else now.
Well, yeah. But I gave them whatever, you know, if they,
yeah,
I really tried to help them get the kids what they wanted, not what they could afford.
Right.
So then the 27th came and I got.
Like, you are like the mafia.
Yeah.
Always doing good deeds.
I'm trying. So then the 27th came and I got fired. And,
they're pumped.
Yeah. Yeah, they were messing around. And no Christmas bonus or anything.
Oh, man.
Didn't get to go to the employee Christmas
party. I can't
believe
we sold out all those hats. Yeah.
So I get fired and I have to go back to regular life, which is like shitty, you know, because I was running the mall.
It would have been great if after that then they came in as if it was a big surprise. Tobler, you're fired!
Yeah.
No, you told me. You told me.
Yeah, like what? So then... Like a month goes by and I'm not doing anything and I So I was like, I got to get back in the mall. So I get a job at Dillard's, the big department store.
Oh, yeah.
And they, so Dillard's had no business in Cheyenne, Wyoming. And so the turnover rate was super high. So I knew I could get a job there. And they didn't know anything about the mafia. So
what I'm saying is Dillard's does not check references.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I didn't put it on my application. So I get a job there, and they you have a quota you're supposed to meet every day there, which is absurd because no one's buying anything. So, like, I worked in the Ralph Lauren polo section, so I had a $3,000 quota. So I'm selling a polo shirt for $85 when there's a Target, like, 50 yards away selling the same shirt for, like, $12.
Right, right, right.
So I always say Wyoming people are like, we have horses at our house. We don't give a fuck if there's a little horse on our shirt.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm not making...
Yeah, Cheyenne is not a polo town.
So I'm not making my quotas. Nobody's making quotas. And they'd flown in all these corporate people that weren't, like, real Wyoming people. Because Wyoming people are very generous, nice, good people. And these corporate people were just assholes. So they would talk shit to us every day. So I gradually started to bring my men's department together and start the mafia over on a whole nother level. So now I have a whole department store. So I have shoes and clothing, not furniture, luggage. I have everything. Yeah. So I convince them, and it's easy to do.
You are moving through this mall like a locust.
But now I'm on a way bigger level. Now I can get anything in town, really, you know, because I have everything. So, and it was easy to do because there was no cameras. There was just one Cheyenne Police Department officer that patrolled the whole store. But for a real cop, that's like a shitty job.
Yeah, yeah.
So he'd show up late, take long lunches, and he'd stay up right at the front and just try to hook up with the makeup girls at the makeup counters. So I put in hand signals to let everybody know when it was time to hook everybody up. So we hook up everybody. And at the time, all my friends are black, just broke. And it's like the height of like Tommy Hilfiger, Nautica. And so I'm like, come in, get whatever you want.
Now, I didn't know there were a lot of African-Americans in Wyoming.
Well, that's just because of Air Force Base. The rest of Wyoming, no. And I was starting point guard, so all my friends are black.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
Well,
that makes sense.
So I hooked them all up. And so everybody, so at that time, I got maybe $1,000 to my name, and I have like a $45,000 wardrobe. I had every Ralph Lauren, but I had every color.
One notices.
No, because no one's selling anything. So I knew inventory was going to come and there would be a problem, but at this point, we just didn't care, you know? So everything's running smooth. I got everything going good. And then one day this dude just shows up. And literally, you don't really sell anything in the store. They just didn't make any money.
Yeah. It's just a dead store. Yeah. It's just like, why are you here? It's
And I don't know how it's still
it's
open.
It's like a Pep Boys in Times Square. Yeah. It's like no one is coming here for auto parts. Exactly.
So then one day this guy shows up and he's just walking around the store and we all try to help him. And he just doesn't want any help. And like my mafia instincts are like, this is not good. So I give the signal to everybody, shut down the whole operation, right? And sure enough,
you're like Hogan.
Yeah.
Please tell me that there's like an empty cash register that like lifted up like a hinge and people went down into the basement.
I wish. So about an hour after this guy walks around the store forever and nobody can help him. And I told everyone, shut it down. Like, this doesn't feel right. Over the loudspeaker, I just hear Brant Tobler, please come to the office. Brant Tobler, please come to the office. And I knew it. I knew we had a problem. I was scared. And then part of me was like, I should just go out the doors and just leave. But then a little part of me was like, that's not what a fucking mob boss does. And everyone in the department's looking to see what I do. So I put my head up high, put my suit coat on, and I walk down to the office. And we get to the office. They take me in this big conference room I didn't even know was there. And there's one long table.
This secret conference room.
Big long table. And then on one side, there's five seats. And then on the other side, there's just one seat for me.
And two words come to your mind. Good news.
Yeah. Promotion, maybe. So I go and I take my seat. And so in comes the head of the store, head of the men's department, head of the women's department, the Cheyenne Police Department officer. And then that guy that was patrolling the store the whole day. That they introduced as Marcus, the head of loss prevention, that had flown in from Arkansas just to meet,
to meet you, to meet you.
We sit down,
Legend. You're like a.
So we sit down, and the head of the store is like an old, like rich white dude, like principal type dude, and he starts doing this thing. Just tell us the truth, we'll go easy on you. You know, just tell us the truth, we'll go easy on you. And, you know, my dad didn't teach me much, but the one thing he taught me is you never snitch, no matter what. Don't snitch.
No, so, he also taught you how to fight in a cold shower.
And don't give only give leftover food to white people at lunchtime, which is what he told me in fourth grade, which is the craziest one. That's the shit he knew about.
But also be funny if you're in the room and they go, I need to stand under cold water and I'll tell you anything.
Yeah. So they didn't know I was built for this moment, like,
yeah,
I say.
Exactly.
So he keeps going, just tell us the truth, we'll go easy on you. And I just kept going, I don't know what you're talking about.
Good for you.
And then they go, so the head of the men's department goes, well, we saw your girlfriend walk out of here with two bags full of stuff the other day, which was true. I'd always have my girlfriend coming to get stuff, but he said that. And I immediately snapped back. I go, well, why didn't you arrest her then? Why didn't you arrest her if that's true? And they looked at each other like dumbasses, you know, and I'm gaining confidence. I think I have them. And then they pull out these letters. They pull out five letters. So
you could have run the table.
Yeah, I thought I was like, I am a boss. So they pull out these five letters. And when I see them, I'm like, oh, shit. Because when you worked at Dillard's, if you had a customer, you're supposed to send them a thank you letter. And then like months later, send them a follow-up, like the fall collections here or whatever.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But I'm not selling anything. So I'm sending those letters.
They have that at Barney's.
Yeah, so I'm sending those letters to my best friend Chance, who's in the Navy. And I just assumed he wasn't writing back because he's busy like defending our country and everything. So I see those letters and I'm like, oh shit. And I start giggling a little bit because I know what's on those letters.
But wait a minute. They can't open your mail.
Well, they had no problem doing it. So they.
But that's the real. Yeah. They're the criminals.
So, but I see them.
I'm going to get you out of this.
Well, yeah. I needed a lawyer at that moment because I was scared. But I giggled a little bit because I knew it was on those letters. Because at the time, I just started getting laid, and Chance was the kid I always looked up to. So they were the most graphic letters of a 19-year-old. And I...
Oh, God.
So the... I start giggling a little bit when he pulls them out. And the loss prevention guy...
I can only imagine.
The loss prevention guy sees me giggling, and he stands up, and he pounds on the table hard as he can. And he goes, hey, boy, this isn't some kind of fucking joke. He said, we just did inventory, and this store is off $600,000. And I was like... Oh shit! You know, in my head, I'm like, my dad would be so proud of me right now. But
do you really boost $600,000?
No. First of all, we did a lot, but I think everyone in town knew their weaknesses.
Yeah.
Because I mean, I'm a 19-year-old, so yeah. I'm telling. I mean, everyone knew.
Yeah.
But I mean, we got a lot, but so
$600,000.
And when he tells me that, I'm like, holy shit! So then they pull out the letters. So in one of the letters, so every letter had the word Dillard's imprinted on it. So at the bottom of one of the letters, I wrote, I am robbing, and then the word Dillard's was there, blind. I have so much stuff for you when you come home is what I wrote. But I didn't write the word Dillard's. So they said, what's this right here? And I said, what are you talking about? It says, you're robbing Dillard's blind. And I said, oh, I didn't write Dillard's. It just happened to be there. I was talking about Sports Fan. And they're like, come on, we know you're lying. And I just stuck to my story. It was absurd. Yeah. Everyone in the room know it was bullshit. But I just kept going, I don't know what you're talking about. So then I was like, all right, I got to do something. So I just stood up and I'm like, that's it, guys. I'm done talking. Just fire me or arrest me. Just, I'm done. Fire me or arrest me. They're like, sit down. We're not done. I'm like, I'm done. Fire me or arrest me. And they look at the cop and the cop's like, let's go outside. And they all go outside. And they leave me in there by myself. And now my legs are shaking. And my buddy had stolen like $500 worth of CDs from Disc Jockey, and he got in like big trouble. So I'm in there thinking like $600,000, I'd be in jail forever, you know? So
I'm going to college.
Yeah, going to college, full ride for a long time. So about 20 minutes later, they come in, the head of the store and just the cop, and the head of the store is just bright red, and he's pissed off, and he sits down across me, has a piece of paper. And he says, Mr. Tobler, just so you know, you're never allowed another Dillard's again for the rest of your life. And he slides me this.
I would have shit with glee when that happened.
And he slid me this piece of paper that I had to sign, and I got terminated for mail fraud, sending personal letters on company stationery is what they got me for. So
that's how they get Capone.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a very good friend who's deathly afraid of flying.
Oh, yeah.
Deathly afraid of flying. And had a book published and had to go to New York for their for the book tour. And they loaded up on Xanax and flew into New York and landed in New York and thought, hey, I did it. Maybe I can conquer it. I mean, they had a debilitating fear of flying.
Sure.
And landed in New York and thought, oh, maybe I'm not going to have a problem with it. Maybe I can beat this. Let me write this day down in the calendar. September 10th, 2001.
No. Oh, God.
Train back.
Oh. Jesus.
It's rarely that people say September 10th, 2001 and then burst out laughing like I just did.
Sure. Well, that's what we heal as a nation. Like
September.
Yeah, remember those days of pure horror?
That was the day I came back. But we were in Bora Bora.
Oh, wow.
Which is the greatest vacation I'd ever had in my life. Terrorizing nature on a ski-doo. I think that's what those things are called.
Oh, yeah, sure, sure, sure.
A jet ski. Or they're called ski-doos, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It was great.
That's awesome. It was amazing.
I came all so relaxed.
Yeah.
God, I'm going to be relaxed for a month. Write down the date. September 10th, 2001. Okay, great. I'm going to be so relaxed.
Have you had that thing, Baron Vaughn had a joke about it, just like where he got off a plane and then the plane, like something like, I don't know why he got off, something to do with it, like a scheduling thing or, you know, but the plane took off and then there was an engine trouble, but then it came back and landed and he was like, ah, like I missed, you know, by laws of mathematics, I should have been on a plane, should have by now been on a plane where it suffered a difficulty or a problem that could not been a crash. And I missed that plane. So now that plane's still coming. Now it's still going to happen. I'm butchering his joke, but it's that thing of...
Well, Seth MacFarlane has the worst story.
Oh, what was his?
Oh, God. He was at Logan Airport flying back to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And got there late, and they had pulled the jetway.
Okay.
And he was like, I have to get on this flight. I'm a TV producer. I have a table read. I have to get back. They couldn't. And that plane went into the World Trade Center.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I never knew that.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
And it's like, does that weird you out? He goes, no. it just doesn't.
I guess.
Yeah.
God, that's crazy. I would have, unending survivor's remorse, I think.
Yeah. I didn't even know how.
Oh, man.
Yeah. It's just like, but I want to, we have to go back to Doug.
Yeah, okay. Let's get in.
Okay. One other really funny 9/11 story.
Yeah. One more.
Yeah. So I wake up September 11th and the shit hits the fan. I was writing on The Simpsons at the time. And we were like, well, no one's going in. And some people had gone in early and they were at work. And then finally, like 11 o'clock, I said, just go home.
Yeah.
And where we lived at the time, we lived right up behind the Chateau Marmont. And so a lot of people came to our house, my wife's and my house. And they're like, everybody's coming over here. We don't have any food. So I literally, it's like 11 o'clock in the morning, September 11th, 2001, and I go to Ralph's to get food because people are coming over my house.
Sure.
And I get like just some hot dogs and potato chips. Like, I don't know what to get. We're not going to cook. We're not going to prepare like a lavish meal. And Ralph's is empty. I went to Rock and Roll Ralph's on Sunset Boulevard. It's completely empty.
Mm-hmm.
And I get my stuff and no one's talking. And the guy who cashes me out just goes, oh, man, you having a party.
No.
Just like that.
Oh.
I was like, no.
Have you not seen the news?
I don't know, sir. I don't know where that came from or how he said it.
Sure.
I mean, yes, I was buying potato chips and hot dogs.
Mm-hmm.
But still. Oh, man.
Yeah. I just went to work. Didn't even think to call in. Went to work and they were like, what are you even doing? Like, you're a waiter. You think we're going to be...
You're a party clown.
And I ended up... Yeah.
Get to Dana's house. Did people like have to put on the makeup?
You're a dirty magician. What's in my hat? Is that my dick? What? Falls off.
Do the show. There's no one here. They're all watching 9/11. Do the show. Da-da-da-da. Putting on boob glasses.
They keep growing more boobs. Just more boobs keep appearing.
And there's no one in the club, but the manager's in the back with his arms folded, kind of looking up to the side, watching the. Oh, they got the Pentagon too. Keep going. Oh, this is terrible. Oh. So many dead. Keep going.
Here, you're in a bar with the live feed behind you on mute, but like the banners going by.
Yeah.
All feared dead.
It's time for the comedy show. It's like when they won't turn up the football game.
Yeah.
Make you go on stage.
Oh my. Hey, look, man, I'm going to do a show. I'm going to leave the news on and turn the sound off, though. I think it'll work fine.
You guys ready to laugh?
Just that, out of politeness. It's the door guy.
He
realizes
he stops.
One, yeah.
You guys ready to laugh?
When we used to do this show called the Lincoln Lodge, which I think they just did a GoFundMe that like myself and TJ Miller and Hannibal Buress and Kyle and some people like and Kumail did like a thing to like try to get, because this is where we all kind of started out. Uh-huh. You know, it was one of those rooms where it was in the back of a diner and in Logan Square, and it was packed week after week, but it was great. We all started out in this kind of era, that was very largely kind of experimental, back in the, so this would be like late 90s,
right.
Early 2000. So, but there was one where, Christmas where Mark Geary, this British guy, would kind of wanted, not a lot of pageantry, but would have different things. Like, let's have a Christmas show and I'll just hire a guy that'll sing Christmas songs too. And a guy went up there just with a guitar playing, Chestnuts Roasting or whatever. And there was a guy named Brian Petrovka who was a massive maniac, very funny, but would just have the most absurd outlooks on things. Uh-huh. He had a joke about how he would, what do you think the best job in all of history would be? And all these people would yell. And he'd wait for them to finish yelling like 30 things. He'd be like, Viking jeweler. Without a question, Viking jeweler, and would go through the wonderments of masculine Viking jewelry you could make for these beefy warriors. So he was just a huge drunk, and he was Santa this year, and he was in the back of the room in a Santa outfit, and this guy's playing the music, and everyone in the whole room is drinking and stuff, and someone gets the idea. There's always that rabble rouser who's like, "What if I let the bull out of his pen and just see what happens?"
Yeah, exactly.
There's all kinds of ways. What that guy said about you? There's all kinds of things.
Yeah.
So some dingbat was like, "Hey, Brian, what do you think of that guy's song? I don't like it. Why don't you tackle him?" And so this guy playing the music.
Tackle.
And it's one of those things where I always go look at this as don't deny the moment. It's a thing of therapy. If you're sad, be sad. If you're angry, be angry. If someone's tackling you while you're trying to play a Christmas song, don't just keep playing your Christmas song.
No.
So this guy, the sound of the guitar thumping, like knocked the wind out of him, and then fell. And then Petrovka kind of wrestling him, and this guy is still maintaining the cordage. Chestnuts, tiny tots, they're eyes all aglow, fine and hard to sleep tonight. Trying to get up, Travka just keeps pushing him down. And it was that thing where people are howling, but because they think it's a real act.
Right.
There were so many.
The guy won't stop.
Oh, I there were so many times when we'd go to shows in these dingy bars, and I'd be like, that was masterfully choreographed. Like, none of that was planned. That was horrible.
But how did you not go to jail?
I don't know. So they just had no evidence. They had no. Oh, they just count on me snitching. There's no cameras or anything.
Right, and they were hoping that you would admit.
They just thought I would fold because I was a kid. And right. So I stood up, and I still thought I was going to jail. I stood up, put my hands behind my back, and they're like, "No, come on, we'll walk you out." And the best part was they could have walked me out the employee entrance right to the parking lot, which may be 30 yards away. But all five of them walked me on this lap around the store.
Sure, they duck walked.
Which
you.
I think they thought would be embarrassing.
No, that's a frog walk.
I think. Well, to me, it was the fucking greatest victory lap of my entire life. Because then I got to the front doors and I was like, "Guys, thanks for letting me work here." They didn't say one word. And I walked out and I got in my car and I left. And
that
then,
must have been that when you got in your car and shut the door.
I pulled around the Target, started crying. I totally melted down. Like, then it hit me of like.
But you also must have been elated.
Oh, I was elated. Like. That night when I told my friends and we drank, like I did, but I shouldn't say that because I still lived in kind of fear. Like I did get away with it, but I was still like,
yeah,
I still was worried, and all my friends are dumb kids too. So
yeah.
They can come get you or whatever.
You are still a mob boss.
Yeah.
You are still the John Gotti of the mafia.
So maybe 3 weeks later I leave town. I'm like, I got to get out of here. So I moved to Phoenix.
You're 20?
To go to college. Yeah, I'm 20 years old. And two of my friends are in college in Phoenix. And I was a really good basketball player and I always wanted to play basketball in college. So I moved to Phoenix to go to this junior college to try to play basketball. So I get to Phoenix, everything's good. I'm going to school. I'm working my ass off.
Where are you going to school?
It's called Chandler Gilbert, a little junior college.
Okay.
And, Phoenix, where we met.
Yeah. So I'm busting my ass. Everything's going great. I have a wonderful girlfriend back in Wyoming that I left, but I talk to every day. And
tons of clothes.
Yeah, I look incredible. I have no.
She looks incredible. Yeah,
she looks great. We look great.
You're head to toe in Ralph Lauren.
I was in so much polo gear. So then
you both looked like George Hamilton. Yeah.
So everything's good, and I. This is before like. Facebook, MySpace, and that. So we're sending letters, personal letters back and forth. Yep. And we're just in love, getting calling cards, talking every hours at night. And then one day I get a letter. I come home and my roommate hands me a letter and I just assume it's from my girlfriend. And then I see it. And then in the top corner in red, I could see a penitentiary. And I just put it down on the table. I didn't even want to touch it. And I was like, this is not good. And I went to dinner that night, went to the gym, did my workout. And I came home hoping that letter was gone. I really did. And I come home.
It would have been gotten up like the Bill in I'm Just a Bill cartoon. I just walked away.
I just didn't. My life was going so good. I just didn't want to touch it. So
I'm just bad news. Yeah. Here's some bad news for Brand.
So I come home. I go home. I walk right by it on the kitchen table. Go to my room. Just like, fuck it. I'm not going to touch it. And I try to go to sleep. And I knew it was out there. I had to go open it. So I went and I got it. My roommates are asleep, and I went and I got it, tiptoed back in my room, locked the door for some reason. I opened this letter so slowly. For some reason, like, my dad's just going to pop out of the fucking letter. And I read it, and it's just like, I miss you. I love you so much. I want to be part of your life again. And at the bottom of the letter, it just said, I'll be at the Phoenix airport in 3 days, and I would love to see you. You know, no time to write back. I'll just be looking for you. So... I didn't know what to do, you know, and part of me was like, I shouldn't go. But then, of course, I was like, I'm going to go, you know. I put on my best outfit, which I laugh about today. Like, my dad has anything of fashion or anything. He's been in the same outfit.
You're not wearing an orange jumpsuit. Yeah. Like, your dad's going to go, wow, you look great.
So I go to the airport, and this is before 9/11, which was the crazy part, is so I can go gate to gate. And when I get there, I realize I don't know what my own dad looks like. I hadn't seen him in like 8 years. So I just didn't even know. So I'm peeking in bars and bookstores like, is that my dad? Or is that my dad? And then I see a guy in a wife beater and a ponytail and brown khaki pants. I'm like, that's my dad. So I run over. I give him a big hug. And we're both fighting back tears. And I'm just talking a mile a minute, telling him, you know, it's just like, I love
my boss.
Yeah. Well, I didn't get to tell him that. But I told him about high school and everything. And then... But he didn't tell me the letter. It was just a layover, of course. So he's like, well, I got to go, son. But I'm going.
I want to be a part of your life. I have 25 minutes before I catch my other flight.
In just his fashion, that's what he did. And so he said, I have a girlfriend in Las Vegas. I'm moving to Vegas. I'm dating this cocktail waitress. And I'm going to Vegas. And
what could go wrong? He's going to Vegas.
So he says, but you're welcome to come visit me anytime. And I was like, okay, you know, so I said, I love you. And we had a good meeting. And I drove home from the airport and I called my two best friends in Wyoming who they didn't have dads growing up either. And we always kind of bonded over that.
Sure.
And I told them this story and they're like, holy shit, that's awesome. And then they called me back like a day later. They're like, hey, spring break's coming up. You want to go to Vegas and see your dad? And I was like, yeah, you know, we'd never been to Vegas. We're just dumb little Wyoming kids. Yeah,
let me interject first. Did you call your mom and your stepdad?
Yeah, I called my mom.
And did she go, what a stupid idea.
No, I called my mom and I told her about the meeting. Uh-huh. I didn't tell my mom I was going to...
What'd she say when you told her that your dad had contacted you?
She just treaded lightly, like, that it went good, you know, because I was a grown-up.
She can't tell you not to see your father.
I think she always wanted... I think, you know, later in life, she's like, I always hoped he would come around. I never thought he would, but I always hoped. You know, you always have hope for somebody.
Yeah, yeah.
So then, like, a month later, we drive out to Vegas on our spring break. And we hang out with my dad for 5 days in this trailer with his cocktail waitress girlfriend. We have the best time, you know. We've never seen Vegas. We're fat. He teaches about getting drinks, everything. We're gambling. It's just like the best 5 days. So at the
end, where are you? If he's in the trailer,
we're sleeping in the trailer. In the trailer, but we loved it. We were barely asleep. It was our first time in Vegas. We were just going out. We just come home and crash. So he says at the end of the trip, he tells us, you know, you guys are welcome anytime you want. You can live here, whatever. I loved, you know, he just tried to go into super dad mode.
Yeah.
So we're like,
I'm going to make it all up to you this week.
That's awesome. But, you know, we got to go back to college. We got to go. So we got in our car.
and he says,
what did you do to go to college? And, yeah. No, I'm really in college.
Yeah, real. I mean, junior college, so kind of real college. So we get in the
car. Look, I just got out of college. No, yeah. No.
We get in the car and we drive to Phoenix. And on the drive to Phoenix, we just, Vegas is in our head. And before we even get to Phoenix, we're like, fuck it. We're dropping out of college and we're going
Vegas. Yeah. With all due respect, you guys are what Vegas was made for.
Well, and
a bunch of idiots.
And this was our brilliant plan. We were driving out of college to go back to Vegas to get jobs as pirates at the Treasure Island. Because we thought that was...
Wait a minute. I have to tell you. The minute I said you guys are a bunch of idiots, I felt bad.
No.
And then
no,
you said that.
100% right. And my whole family agreed with this.
I felt bad for about 4 seconds.
No.
And then you said we were going to become pirates.
Because we were there. There was... I don't know. I don't know if you remember that part of it. They used to have the two dueling pirate shows.
I remember.
So we saw these guys dress up as pirates and jump off the ship every hour, and all the drunk girl tourists would scream for them, and we're like, this is the greatest job in the world. So we tell our family we're moving, we're driving
out. And then
out.
You tell your college advisor that, and he goes, I can't argue with you.
Oh, no, yeah, I didn't tell anything.
Just got to him in the back seat with you.
We're going to Vegas. So we moved to Vegas and we move into the trailer. So my dad lives, it's my dad and his cocktail waitress girlfriend. And then she has a stripper daughter who's like 24. Oh. And then she has another daughter who's in the military who's home from Alaska, staying there. And then she has a son who's 18 who's dropped out of high school and his best friend who dropped out of high school that swear they're training to be Navy SEALs. The two biggest douches I've ever been around would do like 20 push-ups with ankle weights in them. And they thought they were Navy SEALs. So we move in to this trailer.
Okay. You're all in the trailer?
And this is how bad it is in the trailer. So the girls are staying in it.
I got to interrupt. Do the Navy SEALs know that you have to be in the Navy?
Yeah, no. They're the dumbest kids we've ever met. But they swear they're going to join the Navy. Right. They're going to do it.
And so, how do you physically all fit in the trailer?
And there's two loud birds and two little dogs. So this is how the trailer sets up. So there's three bedroom. So my dad and his girlfriend are in one room. The two girls are in their room. And then the five of us boys share one room. So we have a queen-size bed, but it's the queen and then the box spring
right on
the floor separate.
Right.
So if you go to bed first, if you're one of the first two dudes to go to bed, you get the mattress. If you're one of the last two, you get the box spring. And then someone would take the couch or you just pass out on the floor. Just miserable settings. But we were so happy. We were like... Everyone would drink. We were just the happiest little white trash family. So everything's going
good. I didn't want to say it.
Yeah, no. We were a reality TV show way before. But we were actually, everybody was happy.
Two words keep coming to my mind. Downton Abbey.
Yeah.
So. Who was your footman?
So everything, we're having a good time. Everyone's having fun. And then eventually my friends like sober up and their family putting a lot of pressure on them. And we run, no one has any money.
The family's putting a lot of pressure
on
the Navy SEALs?
No, my two friends that move with me, family's like, what are you doing? You can't live, you know?
Okay.
So someone
is from Earth.
So they get their shit together and they move back to Wyoming to go back to school and have regular lives. But I'm loving it.
And they're now both in, you said, U.S. senators.
Yeah. And now they're, I wish for them, but they leave and I'm having fun with my dad and we're having a relationship. Everything's great.
Yeah,
so
you're making up for lost time.
I have to get a job. So I get a job in a casino.
You're both out of college.
Yeah. We're both out of college. And I'd already, that's the third time I dropped out of junior college. So I'm like, I'm done with college. So then I get a job in a casino at night. So my job is from 11 at night to 8 a.m. I have to pull the change out of the machines and count money in the shitty casino way off the strip, which is the worst job when you're broke, is just to count
just
my
surrounded
money.
By money.
So of course my mafia instincts are like, I want to rob this.
Don't do that.
But the mafia has it set up good that I can't. So
don't be a mafia against the mafia.
Yeah. So I have this miserable job and, but I'm working and then, I still love playing basketball. So I get a membership at this gym. There's only one gym on that side of town that's an indoor gym because it's way too hot to play outside.
Right.
So I sign up for this gym even though I don't have the money. It's like $125 a month to go to this gym. It's for like all the rich people in Vegas.
Right.
But I just want to play basketball, so I just do it. And somehow I got sent this credit card, so I put it on the credit card. So I start going to this gym every day, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And at lunchtime, these professional gamblers play basketball. So I was really good at the time, so I started getting on their team, and the one main dude really liked me because I was really good at basketball. So we started being friends, and I started asking what everybody does. I was like, how come you guys don't have to go to work and you got like Mercedes and stuff? Because I, from Wyoming, I never seen a Mercedes. I mean, that's just not life.
Right.
So they're like, we're professional gamblers. And they're like, yeah, that dude's like the main dude. And they're like, he's a millionaire. And I was like, holy shit, I never met a millionaire. So I started being friends with them more and more.
And they are, there are people that are just, they're not in the mafia or anything, but they're just, they are professional gamblers.
Yeah, yeah. So they're just, and they're, they all bet on sports. That's where it comes from.
Oh, okay.
So I, and I love sports. So I started asking him, I'm always
not
like,
the slots.
Yeah. So I keep asking him like, hey, who should I bet on? And he'd always be like, kid, don't bet, you know, save your money. You'll never win. Don't bet. He'd always tell me that.
Yeah.
And then we became friends and friends. I kept riding him. And then I was like, come on, man, just, I think I told him one day, if we win this game, will you tell me who to play? And he was like, all right. And when I played so hard because I wanted to win, because in my head, this is like a gold mine.
Right.
I, once again, I'm an idiot kid from Wyoming. And this is a millionaire that, you know, so he goes, so we win this game. And he pulls me in the secret hallway because in the gambling world, you don't want other people to know what you're doing.
Sure.
So I bite on that hard too. So we go in this secret hallway and he goes, I'm going to tell you four games. These are our big bets that we're betting. Don't tell anyone in the gym that. Don't tell anyone. And I was like, okay, cool. So I, we end up, we end the gym and I run, get home as fast as I can. I tell my dad, like, hey, the millionaire guy gave me a secret games. And he's like, you know, he's a dummy like me. He's like, that's, we got to do it. So I go to my bank. I have like $850, pull it all out. The Wells Fargo's like, is there a problem, Mr. Tobler? I'm like, no, I'll be back with so much money on Monday.
Yeah, promise. Yeah, I'm awesome.
Yeah, where am I going to put all this money? My dad gets $2,500 from his cocktail waitress girlfriend. So we get all
Please
our money.
Please tell me she borrowed it from her stripper daughter. And
she had it. She had her own money. So we get the money. We bet these games, of course. And you already know what happens. We lose all our fucking money. Every dollar of it, we lose. And his girlfriend's furious at us, wants to kick us out of the trailer, but we have no money. We can't do anything. So then about a month later, I go to the gym. And the second I walk in, the guy that gave me the games, he sees me and he comes over to me. And he goes, where you been? I was like, oh, I couldn't come. He goes, please tell me you didn't bet those games. I was like, yeah. He goes, how bad? He goes, I said I lost all my money. And he just started laughing right in my face. He goes, I told you not to bet, kid. He goes, if it makes you feel any better, we lost like $800,000 that day. I was like, nope, not at all. You're a fucking millionaire. I lost all my money. He's like, you know what, kid? Come to lunch with us today. So we go to lunch. So the gamblers would always go to lunch every day, but I was never invited.
Yeah.
And at this time, I wanted a free lunch, of course. So yeah. They're like, come to the lunch. So we go to this lunch, and everybody orders. And then at the end, he pulls out this big wad of money, and he pays for everybody's food. And then he tells me to sit at this back table with him at the back table. And then, so we're eating our lunch, and he's just asking me all these questions. And which now, in hindsight, I realize was a job interview. So he's asking me over and over all this stuff. Why did you come? Your dad, all this backstory. So then at the end, he's like, so what are you going to do, kid? I was like, you know what? I'm just going to save up $1,500. When I get to $1,500, and move back to Wyoming, be with my girlfriend, get a job or whatever. And he's like, you know what, man? You work for me now. And I'm like, what? He goes, trust me, you work for me.
It's coming. Here it comes. It's intermission time. Time to visit our concession stand.
Casper is an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the average price. Casper is revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing that savings directly to the consumer. Designed, developed, and assembled in the USA, Casper is an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. With over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars, it's quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress. It combines memory foams to create an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. And all Casper mattresses are made in America. An award-winning mattress that won't disappoint. Try Casper for 100 nights, risk-free in your own home. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Free shipping and returns to the U.S. and Canada. Get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/Dana and using the promo code Dana.
You know what was awful? World War II. No, seriously. And after World War II, the globe was deeply traumatized as the nations of the world put themselves back into some form of civilized order. In America, which, by and large, emerged comparatively unscathed, losing 500,000 people compared to, say, Russia, who lost 24 million people. But America is where we live, so let's talk about what America did. Deeply traumatized by the effects of the war, American culture slipped into more than a decade of quiet conformity. Or so it hoped.
Sunday, Monday, happy days. Tuesday, Wednesday, happy days.
Yes, it was the America of happy days. Clean-cut, fresh-faced kids in bobby socks and varsity jackets. And everywhere you looked, everybody was happy and well-fed and smiling. As long as they were white. Although women became a large part of the American workforce during the war, once the soldiers returned home, women were unceremoniously ushered back into the kitchen or the bedroom, where they began dutifully giving birth to the baby boom. America in the 1950s was about, if nothing else, cultural conformity, with television acting as a visual guidebook. But as they say, to every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. And in the 1950s, there were many disparate streams of rebellion to counter the tidal wave of white middle-class conformity. The biggest and most important movement was the burgeoning civil rights movement. Black music seeped into white culture through rock and roll, at least once a white guy started singing it. And in the world of literature and pop culture, there were the beatniks.
This is only for the cool cats. Sterile creeps can crawl out now. Upon a certain birthday, dear parents, we do not thank you, dear fumbling mother and father, both, upon this miserable occasion. We give you offerings of respectful loathing.
The Beat Movement, also called the Beat Generation, was an American social and literary movement originating in the 1950s. It was centered in the bohemian artist communities of North Beach in San Francisco, Venice in Los Angeles, and Greenwich Village in New York. Beatniks was a derisive nickname taken from beat, meaning weary, but later said to mean beatitude or beatific, as in beat and down with the world and spirituality. Although it was largely a literary movement, beatniks took their look, their manners, their style, and their hipster slang-fueled vocabulary from jazz and bebop. But to that end, beats loved word jazz, taking poetry and literature out of the hallowed halls of academia and bringing it back to the street. Allen Ginsberg's Howl being probably the most famous poem associated specifically with the beatnik era.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix.
But the Beatnik Bible was On the Road by Jack Kerouac. Born to French-Canadian parents in Lowell, Massachusetts, Kerouac was a novelist and a poet whose rambling style of prose aped the free-form notes of jazz, as if to read his writing was, dare I say it, an act of jazz.
There was a little alley in San Francisco, back of the Southern Pacific Station at 3rd and Townsend, in red brick of drowsy, lazy afternoons with everybody at work in offices. In the air you feel the impending rush of their commuter frenzy. As soon they'll be charging en masse from market and Sansom buildings on foot and in buses and all well-dressed through working man Frisco of walk-up truck drivers.
Working man Frisco of walk-up. That was Jack Kerouac and Tonight Show host Steve Allen on the piano. Ginsberg's Howl, Kerouac's On the Road, William Burroughs' Naked Lunch. Beatniks rejected the conformist, consumerist society of America in the 1950s and embraced personal release, purification, and illumination through the heightened sensory awareness that might be induced by drugs, jazz, sex, and, of course, Zen Buddhism. They wore French shirts and berets, smoked too much, drank espresso, and read their poems in places like the Café Wa in Greenwich Village and Lawrence Ferlinghetti's City Lights Bookstore in San Francisco. Both venues still around, by the way. As the 1950s became the 1960s, beatniks entered popular culture. The popular sitcom Dobie Gillis had a regular character who was a beatnik, bongo playing Maynard G. Krebs, portrayed by pre-Gilligan Bob Denver. From there, they became sort of a cartoon stereotype, showing up in everything from Frankie Avalon and the Annette Funicello beach party movies to, well, the Munsters.
Dictionary? Down the ferry. Mary, Mary, quite contrary.
As the 1960s became the late 1960s, the beatnik movement got absorbed by the much more wild and crazy hippie movement, which was much more concerned with stopping the war in Vietnam than it was with the academic co-option of poetry. Jack Kerouac died in 1969 from issues related to cirrhosis of the liver. You can guess how he got that. But the beatniks were an indelible part of the birth of 20th century American counterculture. I always thought I'd be much more prone to being a beatnik than I would to being a hippie. To begin with, beatniks had cooler clothes, and for my dollar, hotter chicks. Great story if it ends there, right? Well, it does. But it needn't for you. Why not pick up a copy of On the Road, or Naked Lunch, or the Jack Kerouac Collection, the compilation of spoken word albums he released in the 50s and 60s. My favorite novel by Jack Kerouac is not On the Road, it is, in fact, The Subterraneans. Why not pick that up and give it a read? And where can you find these gems? Visit the new library at danagould.com/library, where we have links to all of the books and movies featured in the middle section of the show. Also, on the homepage of danagould.com, you'll see options to donate to the show or subscribe through PayPal. Every cent goes back into the show, and please know we appreciate what, if anything, you can do. And that's not all. You can visit our store at comedyfilmnerds.com for Bevilacqua Heating and Air Conditioning t-shirts, Dana Gould Hour t-shirts, signed vinyl copies of Funhouse, Let Me Put My Thoughts in You, and I Know It's Wrong, signed CDs, signed DVDs, and now signed butternut squash. Just in time for summer.
Make sure you get yours and enjoy it now.
Man was a bread stasher all his life. He never got fat. He wound up with a used car, a 17-inch screen, and arthritis. Tamari is a drag, man. Tamari is a king-sized bust. They cry, put down pot, don't think a lot. For what? Time, how much, and what to do with it? Sleep, man, and you might wake up digging the whole human race, giving itself 3 days to get out. Tomorrow is a drag, Pops. The future is a flake. I had a canary who couldn't sing. I had a cat that let me share my pad with her. I bought a dog that killed the cat that ate the canary. What is truth? I had an uncle with an Ivy League heart. He had life with a belt in the back. He had a button-down brain, wind up, a belt in the mouth, and a button-down lip. We cough blood on this earth. Now there's a race for space. We can cough blood on the moon soon. Tomorrow is Dragsville, cats. Tomorrow is a king-size drag. Fast shorts, swing with a gassy chick, turn on to 1,000 joys, smile on what happened or check what's going to happen, you'll miss what's happening. Turn your eyes inside and dig the vacuum. Tamara Drag.
Hot dog.
Hot dog? Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. The hot dogs at our concession stand do rate an appreciative whistle.
Please remember to replace the speaker on the post when you leave the theater. And now, on with the show.
There was a woman, evidently, who was in love with a friend of mine. And this friend of mine was a very intense guy, one of the smartest guys I've ever known. Like the guy who can talk about both sides of any political issue with
right.
incredible investment and knowledge. And he, this woman, I think it was an open mic, and she got up on stage with a blow up of this guy's high school photo. No one knows how she got it. And she put it on a chair and she started saying, "Well, you've ignored me long enough. And let me tell you why we belong together." From the back of the room, my friend's like, "Get off the stage! I've warned you to leave me alone!" And everyone in the bar is like, "This is great!" And I did not know about this situation, that this woman had been stalking him for months and was seriously imbalanced and just thought they were like soulmates. And he rushes the stage and knocks the thing down. And she's treating him like, "Oh, that husband of mine." Like she won't break... And to have any knowledge. But I mean, long story long, it blew my mind because it was so funny. And then I went, yeah. Oh no.
It's real.
He's really distressed and she's really crazy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This is not some amazingly written. You know, that'd be like a sketch yeah, I could see someone writing.
Yeah, beautiful sketch, yeah.
You know, like where'd you get his high school picture, you know?
There's a woman in New York who's an agent who's a voice talent, voiceover agent. Pretty well regarded.
Uh-huh.
There's only one problem. She thinks she was married to Elvis Costello.
Oh.
And I know somebody was telling me, and I'd heard about this woman.
Yeah.
And then not knowing that I know who this person is, a friend of mine was talking about, yeah, I had this meeting with this agent once, and I was getting divorced, and I was talking about my divorce, and then she was talking about her divorce. And this was somebody that was at it, like, I might sign with this agent.
Yeah.
Pretty well-known voice talent.
Sure.
And, well, it's where my husband, you know, my ex-husband's Elvis Costello, so there's like... song royalty money's involved in the thing, and you know the divorce is a nightmare because it's all these interlocking threads of income. And really, clearly, she knew. You know, it's just like the revenue streams are so diverse, and you know, and like, oh yeah, and then person, the voice talent that was having this meeting later called the person that referred her and said, "I just met her. She's amazing. I had no idea she was married to Elvis Costello. That's crazy." And he goes, "Oh yeah, about that.
Oh,
she's not.
That's the worst. When you have like, someone that like, you're just, oh, everything seems above board. They seem so great. They drowned a family? Oh. Like there's something, there's one thing.
Everybody
just,
has that fatal flaw. Everybody has that fatal flaw.
Yeah. Eric Price, who I was on the last season of Mad TV with, very funny comic actor. He grew up in Wisconsin, and him and his friends in high school would go to the same coffee shop, and there was a handyman guy that would come by and get coffee, and his name was Jeff, and kind of weird, but, you know, Jeff would occasionally seem to have an interest in one of the dudes, but never acted on it. They were high school kids, and his last name was Dahmer.
Oh, no.
He's like, I mean, when you told that story when we were just having beers after, like, a taping or something like that,
yeah.
He was just like, I just knew him as Jeff, and I was like hairs on my neck around the end, like, oh, my God, man.
I see Robert Blake at the Whole Foods all the time.
Man.
All the time.
Wow.
And it's like...
dressed as his character from Mulholland Drive. The whole white makeup. What are you doing?
Is it Lost Highway or Mulholland
Lost
Drive?
Highway. Lost Highway.
But here's the weird thing. Lost Highway, from what I understand, was David Lynch's story about the O.J. trial, about the O.J. crime. And this is apocryphal. I'm remembering hearing this. So,
yeah.
But from what I understand, David Lynch believes that O.J. Simpson did the crime and convinced himself that he did not.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
It's a tenet of that an acting teacher taught me, which is basically like, you, for your each character, you have to find your truth.
Right.
You know, like O.J. doesn't think he did it.
Yeah.
I would never.
Yeah.
I'm O.J. I would never do a thing like that.
Exactly. I'm O.J. I would never do that.
Yeah.
And so he writes a book, If I Did Do It, which is the most, it's just like.
Oh, amazing.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And if you haven't read that book and you have even a passing interest in it.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And you can get the PDFs are all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
But because he was going to publish it and his lawyer went, what the fuck are you doing?
Wow.
And they pulled it like 2 days before it was supposed to go on the shelves. You can't write this.
That's insane.
It's a confession.
That's insane.
So, and no innocent man would write that.
No.
No innocent man would write that book. But in Lost Highway, so David Lynch writes this, gets this idea about a guy, Bill Pullman, who kills his wife and is so convinced that he didn't do it that he actually becomes a different person.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
He becomes Balthazar Getty.
Right.
And the agent of change in that story is Robert Blake.
Yes.
Who later supposedly killed his own wife.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the hiding in plain sight. Robert Blake and his wife at the time were at Michelli's, I believe.
Yeah.
Right down there in Studio City.
Uh-huh.
I believe it's Michelli's.
I think that sounds right, yeah.
Or so, I've eaten there. Mm-hmm. I've eaten there a lot on Tahunga.
Yeah.
Right by the Two Roads Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Where I used to take acting classes. And they were in the parking lot. And then he had to go back in the restaurant. And while he was in the restaurant, somebody walked up to his car, shot his wife.
Yeah.
And then he came out and found her dead.
Mm-hmm.
Why did he go back into the restaurant? He forgot his gun in the booth. I forgot my gun in the booth. You know how it is.
And
you go for pizza and you have a gun.
Because
it's an Italian restaurant.
Well,
we've all seen The Godfather.
We all know, two things fall out of your pockets all the time. Change and guns. Just coins and guns. Like, because a gun is just a thing you just shove in a pocket.
Exactly. It's, you know,
something that could just go off and blow your leg in half.
You're not in Beverly Hills. This is Studio City.
It's rough.
It's a rough neighborhood. You go to get pizza. You need to be armed.
Yes.
And
it's an Italian restaurant.
Exactly.
The Mafia. Have you heard of the Mafia?
Have you heard the song Joey by Bob Dylan? Hello. You go to Clam's Casino, and the next thing you know, you're in the choir invisible.
He goes, you want this job. He goes, I'll tell you what, if you get to $1,500 and you want to leave, you can leave at any time, but you want this job. And I'm like, okay. I just say, okay.
You think, you're a pirate.
Yeah. Then he goes,
you actually did end up working for a pirate. Wait a minute.
Then he said, you want this job. So I go, okay. So then we all stand up, we all shuffle outside, and everyone goes to their cars. He goes, what are you doing today? I go, I got nothing. He goes, just go with Tony. I was like, okay. And Tony was like his right-hand man, who was like this 6'4" guy that was almost a professional baseball player. And everybody at the gym, he was like the cool guy at the gym that I just always liked.
Seems to me that not a lot of good stories start with the phrase, go with Tony.
Yeah. So I was like, okay. So I get in this, and Tony's got a new BMW. I was like, this is so cool. I never rode in a BMW. So I get in this car. And so we got about a 20-minute drive to the strip. So he's explaining my job to me. So he's like, so you just got hired, you're a runner, and what happens is you run around.
So
that's my job title, but I didn't even know what it meant. So then he explains, he goes, what's going to happen is we're going to give you a bunch of money, and a Nextel like pager thing, and then you run up and down the strip and bet what you're told. And I was like, okay. And he's like, so I'm going to train you for the first 2 weeks, and then you'll be on your own. And I'm like, okay. And then about that time, we get to Bally's Casino, and he goes, okay, go in there. And he hands me $22,000 cash. And he says, go in there and bet Duke in football. And at this time, Duke's like the worst football team. And I was like, why would he bet Duke? They're going to lose. And he's like, hey, here's rule number one on this job. Just fucking do what you're told. There's always a reason why we do something. Just always do what you're told. So I was like, okay, cool. And I walked in there and I bet $22,000. My hands were shaking.
Can you walk in and bet $22,000 in cash?
Yeah.
On a game?
So I come in, but then, so they...
I should literally be recording this from the back of a turnip truck. Yeah. I know nothing of this.
So I walk in and then, but they don't, so they know who the runners are, who the bet gamblers are. So when I bet $22,000, they call the supervisors over and they're like, hey, you know, okay, you want this kid? And I'm like, yeah. But I don't, I'm just like, yeah, but I'm definitely timid. They could probably see that. And I hand them $22,000 and they hand me the ticket and I walk out and I hand it to them. So then that was my first time. And then for the next 2 weeks, he took me from casino to casino and introduced me to everybody and showed me where to park, the valet guys. Because from that, so then after 2 weeks, I met him at a sandwich shop and he's sitting at a table and there's a brown bag on the table. And I thought he already ordered his sandwich. And I was like, should I order my sandwich? He's like, sit down for a second. Then he handed me this bag and I opened it up and it was $200,000 in cash. And he's like, this is your money. You're responsible for this money 24/7, 365. This is your money from this point on. So I was like, okay. So then I went to work. And then the crazy thing was I'd go home at night and then I'd lock myself in the bedroom and I'd count the money because I didn't want...
Oh, you're not in the trailer anymore.
I'm still in the trailer.
Jesus.
I have more money than what the trailer's worth, you know? So I'm...
By order of magnitude.
So I would play with it like when I was a kid and I'd get my Halloween candy and I'd like spell my name, build pyramids and shit. And even though I know it's like dirty, I had this money. So my boss had a partner and then his partner came back.
No. You're sleeping in this room with these four other geniuses.
Well, the two of them had left. So now it's just me.
They're in the Navy SEALs by now?
Yeah. The Navy SEALs are, no, my two friends went to Wyoming. The Navy SEAL guys are still around. And then, the stripper girl.
But you sleep with the money? And
yeah.
Like
the stripper girl had got a boyfriend and then, one girl went back to Alaska. So I had my own room and then the two Navy SEAL dudes had a room. So I didn't tell anyone but my dad that I had the money.
Are they still in Vegas?
I would keep it.
In the trailer? Or did they ever join the SEALs?
No, they're still, who knows what they're doing. I'm sorry to disappoint
you. I was hoping that one of them would go on to be the guy that killed Bin Laden.
Yeah. I wish too, but no. So then my boss's partner was in Kentucky for like the first month I worked and he came back and he threw a fit. He's like, because they had problems with the FBI before.
Right.
And he's like, you fucking idiot. You just hired an FBI plant. You're just telling me some fucking kid goes to your super expensive gym, but he lives in a trailer and came here to be a pirate. They're like, this is bullshit. So for like that first month,
it is somewhat incredulous.
I would go out to dinner with them every night. And looking back on it, he was grilling me.
Sure.
Then he realized I'm just a fucking idiot. I'm not in the FBI. So then we were good from that moment on. So then I worked from them for like a year.
Oh, he just kept asking the same questions.
Well, he would just like grilling me because they had definite FBI problems before. Right. So it was a real concern for them. But then they realized I was just an idiot. So then everything's going good. I'm making a ton of money. I'm like, I got to get out of this trailer. So I rent this beautiful house on a golf course not far from the trailer. And I tell my dad, hey, just come. You can come live with
me. How much are you making doing this?
Well, I'm making like $1,000 to $1,200 a week is my salary. Mm-hmm. But then I figured out how it works. So over the next hell, it would beep if we were betting a game. So let's say we're betting the Lakers. They'd go, hey, bet the Lakers -5 is like the line for gambling. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they just go, okay, go get the Lakers if you see it, 4, 5, 6, the line. But then sometimes they go, Lakers now. So when I learned the urgency in their voice over the speaker meant more of a big play it was. Mm-hmm. So then I would go up and I'd say, hey, give me the Lakers for $2,000. And then I'd put that in my pocket. And then I'd say, give me the Lakers for $20,000. And then that was for them. And then that $2,000 was for me.
And is that okay with them?
It was part of the game. So I rent this house and everything's good. And my dad's doing good, you know, because he's on parole this whole time. So he has to take piss tests and he's doing jobs. But I think he's a little jealous of my boss because my dad used to be the man. And he's a little jealous because I'm spending more time with my boss because he's just the coolest.
This is like that movie, A Bronx Tale.
Yeah. So then.
Now, what is your dad doing?
Just cleaning carpets because that's all he can do. He can't get a job. Or he can't because he's like convicted felon.
Right.
But he's always telling us, when I get off parole, I'm going to do this and that. And he's just like, I feel like a trapped man on parole. He must have told us a million times, like, I just want to get off parole so bad. So I my little brother's like a little stoner dude that just follows the Grateful Dead and just moved to Portland and was running a Subway at the time, had a girlfriend, was living this good life for him, very happy. And I convinced him, hey, come to Vegas and live with me and Dad. You know, we can be a family, finally. And, it, you know, after a little convincing, he's like, okay. And I got him a job in the stuffed animal store in Caesar's Palace. And he just loved, he could go to concerts. And he just...
Like a Build-A-Bear?
Yeah, like a lot like that. So he's happy. Everything's good. And at nights, me and my dad and brother would just sit on the back porch and he would tell us about like prison rides and we'd tell him about our each other's lives and caught up and we were like bonding. So everything's going good. And then so one crazy story that'll come full circle is one night my dad was like, when was the time you needed me most? He asked me that. And I go, you know what? When I was like 19, I got an STD and I didn't know what to do. Back then they said if you went to the doctor, they put like a whole Q-tip down your dick, then like your little dick hole. And I was scared to death of that. And during the summer, I was a babysit this kid. And then his older sister got her wisdom teeth out. So my friends told me, just take some of her penicillin. It'll clear up your dick. So I took these three penicillin pills, cleared up my dick, everything. I tell my dad this story thinking he'd start laughing. He turns like bright white, like a ghost. And I'm like, what's up, Dad? He goes, son, when you were like 4 years old, I got prescribed penicillin and I took it. And I'm deathly allergic to it. I almost died. And he's like, if you were allergic to it like me, you would have died. And I was like, well, I didn't. You know, my dick cleared up, blah, blah, blah. So he tells me that story. And I always had that in the back of my head. And so then everything's going good. My brother, we're a happy little family. My dad finally gets off parole. The day comes he's been waiting for years. He gets off parole. My family's over. I'm making a ton of money. I have a big kid, you know, food, drinks. I have all our friends and family over. We have this big party. My dad's super emotional. He's so happy. At the end of the night, it's me and my dad and my brother in the kitchen, just wasted and just so happy. And we're like, we're so proud of you. We love you. And we went to sleep that night. And then that's the last good memory I have of my dad. That's it.
He's been off parole for
He immediately, pretty much the next day, gets on.
Less than 24 hours.
Less than 20, probably maybe 24 to 36 hours. Gets off. Immediately gets on drugs, starts. Now I'm at this time like 23, 24. My brother's 22, 21. He starts bringing over these little gangster kids, like little white dudes that want to be black, like 20 year olds, just like the worst dudes in the world that are the same age as his sons. And he's like 48, probably.
He's hanging out with them.
And he's like locking his door and doing shit. So I'm like the parent and he's like the kid.
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
And it's this weird thing. So then my friends come out for my birthday. And they come.
You're like the responsible adult. Yeah. You have a job.
I'm paying for everything. I'm doing it. It's my house, everything. I give him the master bedroom out of respect because he's my dad, but he's locking the doors and all that shit. So then my friends come for my birthday and we have a party and then someone steals my friend's wallet. And I have a feeling it's my dad. And I bust into his room and I find my friend's wallet under my dad's sink. So I have to go down and, you know, pay and say, hey, man, I'm sorry. My dad stole your wallet. One of the worst things in the world. So then we have a big birthday party. And my dad just blows me off on my birthday. Like I cross passes with him in the house like three times. Doesn't say happy birthday, I love you or anything. And it fucking really upset me.
Yeah.
So we went out that night.
He's high.
And I knew it was my birthday.
He's high. We're trying to get high.
And then we go out that night and I come home and him and his shitty little friends had ate the rest of my birthday cake and still didn't tell me happy birthday. No, it's okay. It's all right. So then at this point.
It didn't even give me the happy birthday. Wow. Mm.
So at this point, I'm like...
Insult to injury.
Yeah. At this point, I'm like, it's going bad. And I'm starting to talk to my boss about... I was like, I should just break my lease, maybe just fuck it. I got to get out of this. I knew something bad was going to happen. So on Saturdays, I'd have to do the college football. So I'd get to the strip at 8 in the morning and run up and down the strip till 8 at night. Just exhausting.
And that's a stressful job.
Yeah. Well, I got to beat the other runners. So it's like me against them. And the better I do, the more money I make. So it's really competitive. And I just work my ass off because I idol my boss and I want him to be happy. And so I work my ass off. And then I have to do the same thing on Sundays for pro football.
Right.
So I come home. It's like 9:30. I'm like, I see my dad and he's, you know, his eyes are big. But I'm like, hey, Dad, I'm going to go to work tomorrow. If you want to come down, I can comp you a booth full of, you know, VIP booth because I bet so much money. I can get everything for free on the strip. Right. Like come down, booze, food for free. If you want to just come down and hang out. He's like, okay, son, yeah, I'll probably come down. I knew he was bullshitting. Right. So I was like, I got to go to bed because I had to wake up early. So I went to bed. I fall asleep at like 10:15. At like 12:30, my little brother busts in the room and he's all shook up. He's like, Brant, someone stole my money. So I hop out of bed and I run downstairs to find my dad to be like, one of your little shitty friends stole Ryan's money, you know? And my little brother had saved up $350 to fly to Portland to see his girlfriend graduate college. So when I get downstairs, my dad's nowhere to be found. So, and my dad had this shitty Camaro that he thought was the coolest car ever. And it always had to be parked in the garage. No matter, like if someone's, even if he was just parking for 20 minutes, he always had to have it in the garage.
Of course
he has a Camaro. So I go through the kitchen and I go into the garage to see if his car's there. And when I go look and his car's gone, and then it hits me like, oh shit, I have all my money upstairs. And I run upstairs and my dad stole fucking $80,000 cash from me.
That George Carlin, Fighting Irish. Yeah, that's great. And I don't think we'd dig it so much if it was the bargaining Jews or the murdering Italians. And frankly, just a mascot, the bargaining Jews. Not even that it's Jews, but just any mascot that's bargaining. I don't want to win necessarily, but what can I get out of this?
By the way,
I'd like to bargain you down. Yeah.
I was flipping the channels and the Phantom Menace was on.
Mm-hmm.
With that weird character of the evil space Jew. The guy.
Oh, yeah, with the huge nose.
The huge nose.
Floating around.
That's my money.
Oh, my God. And the negotiating, like, Japanese aliens.
And he literally has, like, he's like a yarmulke. Like,
this Senate. Like, come on.
It's like a Bugs Bunny cartoon from World War II.
Yeah.
Like, Tojo has
no, and the wacky Jamaican Jar Jar. Like, it's get out of so here with
awful.
This shit.
The whole thing is
it's
awful.
So bad. It's so bad.
It's so amazing. But literally, it's just like, and in the, it's only, you know, it's not 20 years ago or whatever it was.
No.
But you just look at it now and you go like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
You couldn't do that. You couldn't even do that today.
And it's that's why auteurism drives me insane sometimes, because there's, not that you always need to collaborate, but you need different eyes.
You
to
need
look
different
at
eyes, and notes are good.
Notes are good.
Yeah, notes.
Yeah,
are good.
And
some are bad.
Someone,
many are good.
Sure, and too many cooks can spoil the soup. Yeah. But like, you know, if someone just drew that guy, well, he's a wheeler dealer. He's obsessed with money. Let me take a look at him. Here's the drawing. That guy with the giant hanging nose.
The yarmulke.
Like no one. Yeah, the yarmulke. No one was like, fuck that.
Yeah.
You got to change that guy.
What's his name? Jewy Juman. Interesting. I don't think that's a good character for my space movie. And there's evil language.
They were going to call it, like, it's a race called the Jewas, but they already had the Jawas. So they couldn't. It was just too close.
The Hebes.
And, right, just, of course, like, a white goy living in Marin County. No clue of different culture
and the other
cultural sensitivities.
And the planet at the end of that movie is Marin. It's, you know, beautiful roll. It looks like they've attacked Novato. Yeah. It's like just these beautiful green hills. It's fucking Marin.
Yeah.
I'm going to create an entire universe and then it takes place where I can throw this tennis ball.
Yeah.
That is one of the, and you know, people talk about like the auteurism theory, you know, the Sistine Chapel, he got notes on that.
Yeah.
That was a job for hire.
Mm-hmm.
That was a job for hire.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was a gig he took.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think like, you know, how Jim Thompson wrote all his novels and then just had them in the house and they never got published and his wife found them all and they all got published. But it's like, I just think he knew if like, hey, you want to read this? Jesus, Jim. There's no book he wrote that isn't deeply disturbing.
Yeah, yeah.
So disturbing.
My favorite quote in The Killer Inside Me.
Yeah, one of the scariest books I've ever read in my life.
When he talks about hitting the woman.
Is that Killer Inside Me or is that Pop
1280?
1280.
I think it's The Killer Inside Me where he hits a woman and he goes, she folded in half as if on a hinge.
On a hinge. And made a sound like she was laughing until she died.
And then the sickness had won again.
Yep. Oh.
Okay, Jim.
Okay, buddy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the horrifying thing about that book is that you're inside this killer.
Yeah,
the whole
yeah,
book.
Yeah, yeah.
You're looking through his eyes while he's, you know,
and
doing
you realize
his thing.
Why it's justified often.
Sure. That's yeah. Well, sometimes, you know, it's the rule of self. two stand-up comedians that are just deeply sociopathic. That it's funny. There, I used to have a.
We go full Rogan.
Right. I used to.
He's a nice guy.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's. I feel like he's a nice guy. But there are people that like follow him.
Yeah.
Later, you're just like, oh, you need therapy.
Yeah. No,
man.
I get that. Like Adam Carolla. I have a lot of followers that are Adam Carolla fans, and like, it's like, no, he's. He's conservative. You're insane.
You hate women.
Yeah, you have a problem.
I've got a friend that was like, I kind of had to, one of the only times I've had to be like, we're not friends anymore, which is almost harder than breaking off a real relationship.
Oh, yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Because I found out he was being really creepy to some female friends of mine, but he's also this guy who was always just like a cheater. You know, would go in, would just do credit card fraud. He'd stolen.
Sociopath.
He'd stolen the identities of like two of his ex girlfriends, and you know,
the
just,
guy that used to live in this house. This house went up for sale. He lost it to a bail bondsman, or the bank. You know, and then the bank sold it, and a realtor bought it and flipped it, and I bought it and had to. You know,
I hate the culture of flipping houses.
No, I do too.
It's just you. All you want is a quick buck, and
it's
you're ruining the economy. You know what I mean? Like it's so.
But yeah, anyway. And you're the best thing about this house was in the garage. They had the water outlet, the water appliances to hook up the washer dryer.
Uh huh. Yeah.
Not attached to anything. Just sticking out of the wall, nothing in the back.
Amazing.
Yeah. <It's> like, great.
Sure.
Yeah. And the inspector caught it. It's like, this is just nothing.
Yeah.
it's like, okay. You know. And then occasionally one day I was here and I've had people like knock on the door at like 5 a.m. Yeah. Hey, Robert here.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Guys scratching. Hey, Robert here.
Oh God.
Yeah. No. He's been gone for 3 years. And one day, my daughter goes, Dad, there's a weird guy at the door. And I go to the door, and there's this guy like tattoos on his neck.
Whoa.
And I'm like, yeah? And he goes, is Robert here? And I know Robert's been gone for like 3 years. And he just goes, for real?
Nah, he's in. Come on in. Come on in. I got it.
Yeah, no, these kids
he's
are props.
Here. He's here.
These kids are props.
I don't know how to make jokes.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's,
yeah.
I was trying to make it.
And I didn't know what to say because like, clearly this guy, I just went, yes, for real.
Mm-hmm.
For real, sir.
Yeah, for real.
Because you can't be an asshole to these people.
No.
Because they're psychopaths.
Yeah. Yeah. They're terrifying.
Like, yeah. Have a lovely day.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like some cobbler?
Yeah.
I don't have cocaine, but I did make a cobbler.
Well, and it's like.
And so what I found out was.
I kind of wonder, not wonder, I don't wonder how this guy lost this house. I see how he got arrested. I'll just go to my house. Yeah, no, I just keep all the cocaine here.
Yeah.
Just come by.
He apparently tried to steal power from the city, like tried to tap onto the power line.
Oh, God.
Just like so he wouldn't have to pay $23 a month for electricity.
Jesus.
And every neighbor I have has at one point come by and thanked me for living here.
Wow.
Because they go, it's so nice to not come around the corner and see people in handcuffs sitting in the driveway.
Whoa.
Yeah, like it's just a travesty.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That is, I mean, that's, you know, to me, that's kind of criminal with a house rule number one. Like never have it anywhere around
here. Yeah. Never have, yeah.
You know.
Well, that's why the gentleman who used to live here is now, as they say, a guest of the state.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there are, you know, there are people that are just like completely sociopathic mm-hmm. that have no barometer.
Yeah.
No moral compass whatsoever.
Sure. They're
just like.
And it's weird when you kind of get in an argument with that person and they're just like, oh, well, you're so noble. And it's just like, no, I have so many failings.
Yeah.
You know, I do have something of a conscience, but it's like, no, I'm not, you understand? Like you're throwing it back here.
Yeah. I don't, that's a weird thing. Like at the time of this recording, we have just gone through the healthcare issue with the House, and Jimmy Kimmel a couple weeks ago, did that speech about like
the elitist creep.
The elitist creep, yeah. It's like if your child has a health problem,
Oh.
They should be able to have it fixed. And people, fuck you!
Yeah.
It's like,
why don't you stay out of it?
What
That's the thing. It's like, he's a citizen dealing with this problem.
What world? That's when I just go, I don't know what world I live in anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I have a friend who lives in England and has a young, very, very young child who has been in the hospital for a year and has just come out.
Yeah.
But he's like, you know... he said, like, I can't move back. He's an American citizen,
uh-huh.
and he's working in England. He's
right.
like, I can't come back with the medical situation my child has
no.
because it would not be taken care of where it is in England.
Right.
It's just – and the thing about the Kimmel thing, I don't get the creep thing. What's the creep? You're a creep if you want your kid to have good health care? You weirdo? That's a weird fetish.
It's insane.
So
now what is it? What is the length of time from when he's been off parole?
2 weeks, maybe.
2 weeks. So
maybe 2 weeks.
Like, he's been on parole for a year?
No, he's been on parole for like 4 years.
Right. And it takes 48 hours for him
just
to completely.
The minute
he gets on drugs.
The second he knew he didn't have to take piss tests or go deal with that lady, he just immediately got on drugs and was just back to the true person he is. And then
that's amazing.
So then I see my little brother crying.
This is not $80,000 that you can afford to.
No, of course. But I always say
that. Not your money.
People are like, what are you going to do? I was like, there's no job you can show up $80,000 short for. But first of all,
even Dillard's.
Yeah. And I would work for guys you don't want to be $80,000 short with. Not that there's any guys that'd be okay. So I'm sitting there crying, just punching the floor. My brother's crying and he's trying to counsel me. And I'm just like, this motherfucker. And I didn't know what to do. So I was like, let's go. We try to go find him. So we get in a car and we're like, let's try to find him, you know? And so we drive all over. We can't find him. So I have to call my boss in the morning.
Oh.
And tell him I'm sick. So I'm trying to buy time thinking I can get the money back.
And he doesn't want to hear that you're sick.
Yeah, so he wants me to work. But I knew at that time they start to get busy. So I said, hey, man, I know I'm supposed to be down the strip. I've been throwing up all morning. So I was calculated the time I called. He's like, okay, whatever. If you feel better in the afternoon, we need you to get down there. Got to go. Click.
Right.
So then we went back out. We rested for a little bit, went back out to try to find my dad. Couldn't find him. And then that night at like 9, he comes home and he's just fucking out of it. And then we're just screaming at him, like, how could you do this to us? And he's just taking notice. He's like, you probably lost it and just talking shit to us. And we're just getting more mad. And I'm like,
he's in a fur coat.
Yeah. Like,
he's a diamond necklace.
I'm like,
he's in a crown.
Yeah. Like, what are you guys talking about?
He comes in with a king. He comes with the car from that guy that used to be the margarine guy.
Yeah. So he's like, And I'm like, I hate you so much. And we're just saying mean things to him. He's saying the worst things back to us. Like, he tells my brother, like, I don't even know if you're my son. Your mom was a fucking whore cunt and all this. And my little brother's getting more sad. And I'm like, fuck this. We're out of here. And so we stomp out and I get in my car and I'm like, that's it. I'm going to fucking kill my dad. I'm going to kill my dad in that moment. I was like, I drove away from the house and I was like, I'm going to kill him. And all I could think in my head was that penicillin thing. I was like, I got to get to some penicillin.
That's right. He's allergic
to penicillin. It was like the game Clue. Like, I knew the murder weapon. I just didn't know what room and who was going to do it. So I call my cousin who lives in Phoenix, who's like a real gang member. And like, our family's badge of honor was he's the youngest guy to ever go to the Wyoming penitentiary. But he is.
I think it's called college.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. He went to college early. But he's the most loyal person in my life and would do anything for me.
All those gang guys are pretty loyal from what I understand.
So I call him. I tell him what happens. He's like, I'll be there in 5 hours. He gets in his car. He drives right to Vegas. And when he gets to my house, he's like, where's he at? And he's like ready to kill him. I'm like, hold on.
Does he show up solo or does he have some people?
Just by himself, just straight on a mission to get him. And so he gets there.
Does he know your dad?
Yeah, he knew of him. And like his mom hated him. Everyone just hated him.
Right.
And he just knew how upset I was when I called him.
You're $80,000 upset.
Yeah. And he just knew. So he drove up and he's like, when he gets to the house, he's like, where's he at? And I was like, hold on. I got a plan. So we grab a beer. We go out to the back porch. I go, this is what we're going to do. So I'm going to fly to Estes Park to the Stanley, ironically, and be with my girlfriend because everyone's going to think it's me. And I said, no one knows you're here, Cato. So what we need you to
His
do.
His name is Cato.
Well, his name's Cade, but we all call him Cato.
Please tell me he had the mask and everything.
No, he's all business. But he was he had a bag with I never know what was in the bag. But so I said, this is what we're going to do.
Army men.
I need you to get some penicillin. He's like, I got it. And because he could get
your dick again? No, listen to me.
I call him my ghetto concierge. He can get anything in any town at any time.
I'm sure, yeah.
So I say, I'm going to fly to Estes Park, to Colorado. I'm going to go with my girlfriend, so I'm not here. And no one knows you're here, so what we're going to do is pack up all Ryan's stuff. And my dad, so there's a Jamba Juice like four blocks from my house. My dad used to always get these Jamba Juices. So he said, what we're going to do is get a Jamba Juice, fill it up with penicillin. You'll give it to my dad when he starts drinking it. You guys get in the car. You drive to Phoenix. I'll be in Colorado. Someone will find him dead in a couple of days. We'll be off the hook. You know, obviously a dumbass plan. This is before Dexter, Breaking Bad, or anything. And I've never killed anyone before.
Yeah. But this is just your dad.
This is the plan I came up with. So Cato and my little brother are like, okay, I guess. So, so then my dad comes home and then we kind of hid Cato out at like, he didn't stay at the house. So we didn't want my dad to know Cato right. was there. So then I fly to Denver and I go to Estes Park. And then the day of everything is set to go down, Cato's already got penicillin. Everything's good. I call him from my hotel. I said, hey, what's the deal? And they're like, we're good to go. We got a large mango in the fridge. We're just waiting for him to come home. And I'm like, all right. So I said, just call me when he's dead. And they're like, okay.
God damn
it. So like an hour later, I don't hear from him. About an hour and a half later, I don't hear from him. I call him. I go, hey, what happened? They said he came home, and we gave him, my brother gave him the Jamba Juice, but he didn't drink it. And I think he was definitely weirded out to see Cato there. But he was also in maximum security prison. Yeah. So he knows not to take a gift from your enemy, probably. So he just took they handed it to him. He set it on the kitchen counter. He went upstairs and got high or whatever. So I said, what happened? They go, well, he didn't take it. And I was like, you know what? Fuck it, man. Just get in the car, go to Phoenix. I'll fly back in a couple days. We'll move everything out and I'll just fly out, you know? Because I had told my boss that my uncle had died and I had to go to Cheyenne because we were still just trying to buy time.
Yeah, because you still owe somebody.
I thought somehow
you still owe a professional gambler basically $100,000.
I thought somehow I could get some of the money.
Yeah.
So I tell Cato that. I'm like, you guys go to Phoenix. It's done. And Cato's like, nah, fuck that. He's like, we do it my way now. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, well, I didn't come this far for this shit. What he did to you, we do it my way. And I'm like, what do you mean, Cato? And he's like, we'll call you in a little bit. And he hung up the phone before I could even get a question. God. So what they did, so then my dad leaves. He walks by the Jamba Juice again. He doesn't drink it. He leaves. So what they did was they knew that fucking Camaro had to be parked in the garage. So they open up the garage door and then they cut all the power lines and the phone lines. And they just wait in the dark corner of the garage, wait for my dad to come home. Like an hour later, my dad comes home, pulls in, parks his Camaro in the garage. He's hitting the garage door opener to get the door to protect his precious Camaro. It won't shut. So, my cousin told me he was so frustrated in the car because he didn't know why it wouldn't shut. So eventually he gets out of the car, walks over, manually closes the garage door, locks it. Then when he turns around to walk back into the house, my cousin and brother jump out with golf clubs. And they try to kill him with golf clubs in the garage. But... I always say we had a bad murder caddy because I don't know if they picked the wrong clubs.
Golf clubs of all the things.
But what they fucked up with was that...
That's not what I assumed, like a gang member.
Yeah.
You do it with golf clubs.
There was no light. So they're swinging away in the dark and they said they hit him a couple times pretty good, but there was no... You know, they were also scared to hit each other. So there was just a door... There was a door on the side of the garage that led to the side of the yard that led to the backyard. And on that door, there was a little doggy door on the bottom. So that was the only light that was shining through. So my dad saw that light and just survival, put his shoulder down and just crashed through that door, fell into the side yard, ran to the backyard, jumped over the wall, and escaped onto the golf course. And then I never saw him again from that day.
Oh, my Christ.
He was gone. And you know, I tell – so in the book, growing up, my dad always said – my dad, over and over, blood is thicker than water, son. Blood is thicker than water. And I hate that saying because it's whenever he fucked up, instead of saying, I'm sorry, what he pretty much said is, hey, the same blood type. You have to put up with my bullshit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's so very self-serving.
In the one-man show, I say, and then 3 days later, I came back and I was standing there in the garage with a hose trying to clean up the floor. And I realized my dad was always right, that his blood is a lot thicker than water.
There was a picture online of a guy that had a truck, and like the back there was littered with stickers. Mm-hmm. It was like America, like July 4th, 1776, died January 9th, 2008.
Sure.
You know, it's like, you know, coexist, but written out in weapons.
Right.
You know, and then it was like, relax, America, the alpha males are back.
Good.
It's just like,
hooray.
And you just want to go like, you have a problem.
Yeah.
And you couldn't have more sand in your pussy right now.
Yeah, exactly.
You couldn't. Like, the thing that I've been liking is you know, exactly there's right. So many funny people that I follow on, like, Twitter and things. And all they have to do is repost, like, one of Trump's tirades that says, and, like, when you're definitely not mad. You know? They always try to act like they're unflappable and we're the snowflakes. And it is such the opposite.
Oh, by God, every single show I do, I get walkouts.
Sure.
And I do three or four mild Trump observations.
Because there has to be pushback on any, you know, the most.
I'm the snowflake.
I wrote just online that you know, all you people making those, oh my God, Barry Manilow came out, my mind is blown jokes, and just, you know, just like, go save it. You know, he's America's troubadour. You know, like he picked his time and that's it. Who cares? You know? I just think it was just so easy and so dumb.
Yeah.
And the amount
of people.
It's a layup. The amount of people that wrote to me, I just don't care what he is. I love, just like, no. That's you saying you don't want to deal with his gayness. That's what you're saying. Yes. You know what I mean? Like, there's a great quote about, there's a woman did a
the
profile.
The song was called Randy.
It's about a dog. It's about a dog. When that Rachel Dolezal woman who since changed her name to something incredibly black. It's some name that you're like, oh, I think it's like a Feeny, it looks like Tupac's mother's name. And the woman who interviewed her was like, I don't want to interview this woman. This black journalist was like, I think she's gotten enough press. And, you know, her thing now is like, she's in Spokane, Washington, which is just, there are no black people. So she had to become one, evidently. Yeah. But like, this woman interviewed her and was like, first thing she said was like, she looks incredibly white. You know, and during the interview, this Rachel woman kept going like, everyone just thinks I'm black. So like, no, they don't. And it's just this, the great point that the journalist made was just kind of like how, and one thing that Rachel kept saying was just like, you know, people say, you know, girl, I don't care if you're green or purple. And it's like, that's a phrase that people throw around a lot. And sure, they wouldn't care if you're green or purple. They're sure as hell going to care if you're black. You know what I mean? That's where we are in America. They do care, you know?
They really care.
Yeah, it's like, if you're purple, maybe you're some kind of weird celebrity. Well, you're an alien, you know, like, but that's a term white people throw around a lot. I don't care what someone is. They could be polka dot, which you would be weirded out if they're polka dot.
Yeah, exactly.
But like, yeah, it's like.
As long as they're not black.
As long as they're not. So ridiculous.
I guess it goes to like, you know, I have the same intolerance, but you know, my brother is a crazy like right-wing conservative.
Sure.
My brother that dented my car.
And
he's the biggest nut I know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my brother's a lunatic.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't understand the hostility and it's beyond the point of saying now, like, to me, the things that the Republican Party used to stand for, like, we're moral, we're not like these degenerate abortion having divorce drug taking liberals, at least that was a stance.
Yeah,
you know, we're Ozzie and Harriet America.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
No, you're not.
No.
Nope.
No.
Nope.
No.
No. You sold a, you stand, you now stand for nothing.
Right. And because you've taken truth and thrown it out the window.
Yeah.
Like there's debate with just like, you know, put it down to taxes. You know, liberals just want to spend money. Well, yeah, on social programs and helping people. Yeah. And someone like, well, I don't want my money to go toward that. And it's like, okay, that's a discussion.
Yeah.
We can talk about that. That's a thing.
Yeah,
you know what
exactly,
I mean?
Yeah.
If a right winger is like, I don't want to pay all these taxes to support the arts, let's get a debate going.
Right.
I understand, man. You know,
yeah.
I'm greedy too. You know, like, I get it. But then when it's all out the window and you won't even stand
on
facts.
When they go to like, I don't want to pay for the fire department.
Like, oh.
Well, that was the hilarious thing. On the other hand, it's just a annoying back and forth.
Yeah.
Like it is, it's just for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction.
Yes.
It just takes longer than you want it to.
Yeah.
You know, and to that point, no side is going to win.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know,
there's going to be give and take. There'll be little victories along the way, and both sides.
You know, now, you know, the Republicans are on the defensive,
mm-hmm.
and over time, over a cycle or two, the Democrats will be in charge of everything.
Sure,
it's just going to go, and they'll undo everything
mm-hmm.
with the climate. You know, it's possible that we're playing.
Yeah, no, I heard you talking about with Pepitone about that. It's horrifying, right?
Yeah,
now.
We might have a 100-year window to fuck around.
God, yeah. But it's the abortion thing. The abortion thing.
Yeah.
Let's start right there. No, if you get a chance, there's a play called Roe that I saw at the Ashland Shakespeare Festival. That mm-hmm. If it doesn't go to Broadway, there's something wrong with the world. It's incredible because right. it's hilarious. Like it's not only it's about that case, that right. landmark case. You learn a lot, but it's also incredibly funny, uh-huh. like throughout it. And they use actual recordings of the case. So. Roe with her lawyer, the actresses will talk, and then the playback will be the actual Supreme Court judges from the actual thing. And the thing that and the only thing I'll say was that just killed me, that was unintentionally hilarious, was the guys who were, versus mm-hmm. Roe, versus a woman's right to choose, the guy was so confident that his case was going to crush that he led with a joke. In the beginning, he's like, well, I was always told you go up against two attractive ladies, you're going to lose. if it may please the court, you're all right. He thought he'd get a laugh when these two women fighting for their rights. Let me tell you, pretty ladies, I'm intimidated. No smile? You'd look a lot better if you'd smile. And that's the recording.
Yesterday.
Oh my God.
Yesterday, what was her name? The attorney general that Trump fired was testified before the Senate.
Oh, Yates?
Yates. And last night at Christmas.
The brutal spanking of little bitch baby Cruz.
Oh, that was fantastic. That was fantastic.
Sorry,
it was like
go on.
It was like watching Miss Jane Hathaway pimp slap Grandpa Munster.
Yeah.
What was amazing is on Chris Matthews, he goes, she was certainly very attractive. Give me a testimony.
Chris.
Certainly very attractive.
Oh. Chris Matthews is your drunk friend from high school at a pool party and you're adults.
Yeah.
And you keep just saying, he's harmless to everyone. Oh, he's harmless.
Yeah. He's like your racist uncle that doesn't think he's racist because he loved Wilt Chamberlain.
Right.
great player. Best player to ever play.
You can't say I have any problem with yeah. his people.
Yeah, exactly. James Brown, amazing dancer. Yeah. Come on, how can I have hate in my heart when I watch Flip Wilson?
A lot of them are violent. A lot of them they will chase white women in the street. Not James Brown.
Not James
Stuck
Brown.
Stuck to his own, a man of class.
Stuck to it.
Jesus.
Stuck to
Uncle
his
Chris, son. Just be quiet.
Out there, predators. Predators.
It's in the genes. You know.
My father frequently, whenever he would see a mixed race couple, they'll fuck a refrigerator if it's white.
Wow.
My dad.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And
you know what?
My
he's right.
Hell, I will. I love a big boxy fridge.
Oh, jeez,
come on,
big boxy fridge.
That rubber sealant when you shut the door on your dick.
I like big fridges. I cannot lie.
My favorite was my uncle. I said something about. Oh no, that's what it was when Tiger Woods came out and was crushing and everyone was just like, he's America's golden boy.
Yeah, I love that his
fetish for waitresses at Denny's,
I love that a black guy dominated golf.
Sure.
The last bastion.
Yeah, like
white privilege.
Charles Barkley is like, something's wrong with the world when the best rapper's white and the best golfer's black. But he just said, I was like, he's undeniably, he's the best. And everyone's like, he's the best golfer. He's the best. And my uncle's like, come on. It's like, who then? Who? You know? And he's like, and Hitler was a great orator. That was his comeback. What? Doesn't even make any kind of sense.
Yes.
And?
Yeah.
And also grow a mean, weird chaplain mustache. What's your point?
No. Yeah, I don't know where it ends. I don't know where it goes. Like, man, and every day the lunacy is.
Well,
is
the longer you stay, you know, it's the longer you stay in that kind of in your comfort zone, the more you want it. You know, and it, when you stay in this kind of hateful comfort zone, that any kind of poke or prod from anything factual just hurts, and you scream back at it. It's kind of you're just going to keep kind of digging yourself deeper.
So he disappears,
and he left his Camaro.
No, he. I don't know how he came back, and he came back and got the Camaro.
He came, there are members. There are people that are waiting to kill me, but I've got to get my Camaro.
So when I come back 3 days later, because my brother and Kate took off right after that.
Sure.
So he came.
Don't blame him.
He probably came back to the house with his crew or whatever and saw that. But he really just came and got his Camaro, and he didn't get anything else because I bagged up all his shit and threw it away.
Right.
So then he disappeared. So he's gone. So I'd never talked to him or heard from him.
And how long ago was that?
So that's 16, 17 years ago.
Okay.
So then I have to go tell my boss that the money's gone.
Yeah, that's where I want to get to.
Okay, so.
You owe a professional gambler $80,000.
And he's like my hero.
And you can't get it back.
Yeah, and he's the one person in life that has changed my life, and I don't want to disappoint. He's literally the guy I wish was my dad. So I go to his house.
And his name is not Huffenden.
Yeah. So I go to his house, and he has three sons that are, at the time, probably 11, 13, and 15, and they love me.
Right.
So I get to his house, and I park down the street. I couldn't get out of the car. Every time I'd start to get out of the car, I'd just start crying because I knew what I was about to have to go face, and I just didn't want to disappoint this guy. So I finally got the courage to go in, and I go inside, and his three boys are like, Brant, you're back, and they thought I was at a funeral. And he sees my eyes are all red and puffy and knows something's wrong, and he's like, are you all right? And I was like, hey, can I talk to you real quick? And he's like, yeah. And we go back into his office. And when we get to the office, the second he shuts the door, I just start bawling. I'm like, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to do it. My dad stole $80,000 when we tried to kill him and all this. And he's like, wait, what? What happened? And I'm like, because the one lesson they always told me in the gambling world, he's like, once your reputation's gone, you're gone. That's it. So I was like, I ruined my dream job. I disappointed the person I idol. And I tell him that. And he's like, wait, what happened? And so he's like, and he was so cool about it. He goes, first of all, if you ever have a problem, you come to me. You don't go kill people. He said, we're running a monster operation here. We can't have that on us.
You
come to me. He's like, you know, we can always make more money. And he was cool about it. He's like, you know, desperate people just do desperate things. And I'm so sorry your dad did that to you. And he's like, we'll be okay. We can make more money. But just, you know, from now on, if something happens, you always come to me. Don't do this street justice by yourself.
Do you really think that you're going to get killed? Like, I'm going to get killed.
No, not killed. Just like, it was just my whole life. He was like the person I spent every day with him, and I loved his kids.
Do you still know him?
Well, no. I mean, we know each other, but then, of course, in the end, it all, in true Vegas fashion, it always ends. So then at that point, he took me in and let me see. He had a huge, like, 12,000 square foot mansion. He let me live there for a while. And then he was like, going through a divorce with his wife, and my other boss was, so they just wanted a house they could go do whatever they wanted at.
Right.
So then he said, hey, go rent a house that we'll work out of, which would be quote unquote the workhouse, but then it also had a master bedroom. So I would live in this house. So he goes, they pick out this house. He said, go get this house. So I go to get a house, and I go in, I was like, hey, I want this house. I fill out all the paperwork, and they come back. They're like, you can't rent a house. You have the worst credit score we've ever seen. So of course, Brant.
What did you do at Dillard's? Yeah.
So, of course, my dad, after he...
Run to Dillard's and get some towels.
After my dad got away that time, then he, of course, stole my credit and just ruined my whole credit.
Oh, no.
So that's why I can't...
So that's how you know that your dad was still around, because he stole your identity.
Yeah, so he stole my identity. And then...
did you get that repaired ever?
I went to the police, told them everything. They're like... I showed them all the evidence and everything. They're like, we'll call you. We'll call you. I'm still waiting for that phone call. It's like, that's a joke.
So do you have credit now? Or?
So of course I made a bunch of money. I was making money. So then I had to pay. I just paid off everything he ran up.
Ugh.
And then he did it again. And then I'm just screwed for on that. So then, and then that was my favorite part. So then I call my boss back. I'm like, hey, I can't get this house. My credit score is awful. And he's like, well, how much is the rent? I was like, it's $3,000. He's like, how much is the deposit? I was like, $3,000. He's like, just go in there, tell them you'll bring $40,000 cash tomorrow, pay for the whole year's rent, pay for the deposit, and give $1,000 to see if it gets done. And I was like, okay. So I walk back in. I go, hey, I got one more question. I know you didn't approve me, but if I just bring $40,000 cash in tomorrow, you know, and you get $1,000 for yourself, and they're like, hold on, let's go see. And then 10 minutes later, they came out, Mr. Tobler, you have a house. So that was always like one of my favorite gambling stories. So then, so we have this.
Would you like a piece of cheesecake, yeah. Mr.
So we, I have this house, and then we start betting hockey, and then we just make a ton of money. So we have this hockey guy comes in.
Now, did you ever try to like pay back the 80? Like, here's 2,000, no, here's 4,000.
He was cool about it, just because I just worked my ass off for him, and he knew that all along. I made him a lot of money,
right?
And he knew I would never do. You know, he was just like. Your dad, you know, the funny thing is the next day, because I thought the other boss would be mad, and he's like, it's okay, man. He's like, you don't have another dad, do you? And I was like, no, we're good. So then
that's amazing.
Everything was going great, and we're making all kinds of money. And then the poker boom hits, and my bosses they made a lot of their money start out in poker. So then they're like, screw it. We're not going to bet on these college kids to make a field goal in the snow when I can just go to a table and beat the shit out of college kids. And I've been playing poker for 40 years and they've been playing for 10 months.
Right.
So, and the poker boom hit and they were on TV.
Texas Hold'em boom.
And they got kind of famous from being on TV. So they were like, so the gambling thing died and I started dating this Mormon girl. I fell in love with this Mormon girl. And so I quit.
For the sex.
Yeah, well, I trust me, I worked my ass off for that sex. To go dry hump for a year when you're 28 and have been fucking hookers and shit and had a lot of sex in your life was the hardest thing I had to go through. So I fall in love with this Mormon girl, changed my whole ways. I want to marry this Mormon girl, but I just don't, I can't do the, so I, she's incredible. So I decide to take the meetings and try meet with the missionaries and everything, do anything to try to be with this girl.
Right.
But I can't, the meetings are such bullshit. And then the funny thing that happened is on the fourth meeting, they came in, and at this point, I've done everything I just said up to this. Mm-hmm. So I'm like 28, and there's like an 18-year-old from Boise, Idaho, telling me how I should live my life. I'm like, you haven't done shit.
Yeah.
And the funniest part about it was they came in, and one of them was just passionately telling me, like, this is what you need to do with your life. And he fucking forgot to take off his bike helmet. So I always say on stage, I'm like, I don't know a lot, but I know you don't take life advice from a guy that wears a helmet indoors. So then I told her, like, hey, I just can't do the Mormon thing. And then so then the bishop made her break up with me. And then
wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, and broke my heart. And then so I had
to. She did it?
Yeah. Well, she wanted, that was her whole life dream, was to get married in that temple. She'd always be like, you know, and we end up having sex, which was obviously she wasn't supposed to do that. But she still, I don't know the rules, but she still always wanted to get married in that temple. And she told me we can have like two weddings. And I was like, I mean, I'm not a girl, but I'll be honest. I want one wedding in my life. I don't want to have a first wedding that nobody important to me can be.
Somebody whose goal in life is a wedding ceremony, that's the week after is a big letdown.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I didn't want to just, so we'd do that wedding, but no one important to me could be there. Right. And then I could do my wedding at a park or somewhere. I was like, that's not what at that point, I want to get married. So then we break up, and then she does the Mormon thing, immediately gets engaged. And then backs out like a week before the wedding and comes home and says she wants to be with me. And I go back to her. But then she's like, we got to start all over. And I was like, we can't. We've had sex like 1,000 times. I'm not going back to dry humping. I'm almost 30. It hurts. The zipper hurts. So she's like, I just got to keep my body pure and get married in the temple. It's important to me. And I was like, I respect that. So we broke up. And I was crushed. And then, of course, she gets a boob job and marries a Jewish guy on a golf course eventually. Which I was like,
Jesus Christ,
trying to win against the old keep your body pure temple thing. So I fall into like deep depression.
Jesus Christ.
We're done gambling.
Do you ever talk to her?
Oh, yeah, we're friends now. Her dad's still my dentist. So
her Mormon.
She's great. She's a great girl, and she deserved way better than me. She made the right choice, honestly.
Happy.
Yeah, I'm very happy for her. I'm very close with her whole family still.
Okay.
So then.
That's crazy.
But then I fall into depression. I have to go live in this shitty apartment, and then. And the gambling's over. So now I had all this money, and now it's just stopped. And I, of course, didn't spend any of it. I mean, save any of it, because it just felt like fake money. We just were always making money. So then.
Right. You don't value it at all.
So I have no money, and then I live in this apartment with my boss's son, and this. We have to get a roommate because we're running out of money. And this dude moves in, and he just starts trying to rob us all the time, and he's on drugs. And it felt like just being with my dad again, but I had nowhere to go. So at that time, I had maybe. $8,000.
What was his penicillin tolerance?
Yeah, I don't know what his weakness was, but so I had like $8,000 to my name that I had to keep with me at every second. When I took a shower, I slept with it in my pillowcase because he was always trying to steal from
me. Jesus. So is this in Vegas?
Yeah, and I never felt worse in my life, and I just didn't know what to do. And then sure enough, one day at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, there's a knock on the door, And it's like a Tuesday, and I'm about to go to lunch with my best friend, Justin. And I'm like, come in. And the door opens slowly, and it's this little Mexican dude. And there's a couch, so I can't see if he's holding anything. Neck tattoos and everything, but I just thought he was coming to see, because my two roommates were on drugs at this point, and I just, shady people would come and go. He's like, hey, man, is your roommate here? I was like, yeah, he's just in down the hallway to the right. So he walks in, and when he turns around the couch, I see he's holding a shotgun in a case.
Jesus Christ.
But I'm from Wyoming, so that's not like, and it's Tuesday in an afternoon in an apartment complex, so I didn't think anything about it. And he didn't shut the door the whole way. He didn't, it was still open a little bit. And part of me was like, I should just go shut it. But I was like, I'm about to leave. Let me watch this last segment of the show I was watching. Then I'll get up and leave. And I didn't make it in time. And sure enough, he walks out with the shotgun, walks over, puts it about 10 inches from my face. And he's like, give me all your fucking money right now. And I, like, in the moment, it didn't, I wasn't scared. It just, I was
shocked. No, I've had a gun in my face before.
Yeah, so you don't realize it. Yeah. So I was
you just get incredibly cooperative.
Yeah, well, no, I was dumb and I go, I don't have any money.
Oh, Jesus.
And he goes, but that's just the first thing that came out of my mouth. And he goes, okay, and he turns around and he walks off. And I'm like, that's it? And he walks over just like Bronx Tale, walks over, shuts the door, and he locks it. And in that moment, when I heard that lock click, it fucking got so real. I'm like, I'm going to die. I was like, I got money right here. So I pulled out the wad of money I had in my cargo shorts. And then it started going, I got more money at the bank right down here. If we can just go, I'll go to the bank. I'll give you all my money. I got like $40,000 in there. I'm just lying. I have no bank account or anything. But I'm just thinking, I got to get out of this house because I'm trapped. And he's like, and I give him the money. He's like, that's it. Stand up. And I stand up and he puts the gun in my back. And we walk down this hallway and we go in this room. And we go into my roommate's bedroom, and my roommate's on the couch, not on the couch, on his bed, trying to pretend like he got robbed too. And he's like, but it's such bad acting.
Oh, I see what happened.
So he takes me in there and he goes, sit in the corner and don't move for 10 minutes. If you come back, I'll fucking kill you. Or if you call the cops or something, I'll come back and fucking kill you.
Right.
That's not, you can rob me, but don't put me in timeout like a little kid. So he leaves and I can see out the window. So this is on the first story floor.
And does he leave in your roommate's with you?
And my roommate's with me.
But they're in it together.
They're in it together. Right. So then I wait a few minutes, not 10 minutes. I can see the car like drive off. And I stand up, I'm like, fuck you. I know this is bullshit. And I leave and I go out to my car and then I drive off the lot and I call my boss. I'm like, I just got robbed. What should I do? And he's like, you got to call the police. I was like, I can't call the police. He said he was going to kill me if I called the police. And my boss is like, if he's going to kill you, he would have done it. You got to call the police. And I was like, okay. So I called the police and then they come back. So then the police meet me in this Chili's parking lot where I'm at and they bring me back to the apartment complex. And this dumbass goes and robs two more houses after he robbed me. And
that guy?
Yeah, he gets caught while they're taking my statement. So they catch him. And then I'm like, oh, okay. But then
different police catch him.
Yeah, they catch him and call the police, say, we got this guy. We think the guy, he robbed somebody else. So they catch him and then, but I'm fucked because I didn't realize. So my money's now evidence.
Right, you can't
So
get
I don't
it.
Have any money.
Right.
I'm screwed. So, and then this family, the guy that robbed me's family reaches out to me and they say, hey, with this story, like, hey, it was the guy's
dad.
You have
any money?
No, he's like, we'll give you $500 not to testify. Because my son has a baby on the way and all this shit. And I'm like, no, I'm going to testify.
Oh, no, yeah, no, no.
So, because I have to get my money back.
Plus, that's illegal.
Yeah.
You go to jail for that. Obstruction of justice. Yeah. Something like that.
So, my best friend lets me just crash on his couch and he throws me a couple hundred and I just survive until my court date. And then I have to go to my court date and his whole Mexican family comes. And at this point, I'm just by myself in life. It's like, and it was just scary. I had to go up there and I testified with them all just staring at me. And it was so shitty. And then, and so I testify and everything.
You're the bad guy. Yeah. At the end of the day.
Everyone's mad at me.
At the end of the day, you're the bad guy.
And then
guy.
I still don't get my money back and I have to wait for it all to end. And then a crazy thing about it, so I'm sleeping on my best friend's couch. He takes me to his parents' house maybe 3 months later and I'm sitting on the kitchen counter. And he's like, my mom and dad are coming home. I want you to meet them. I'm like, cool. His mom walks in the kitchen and she sees me sitting on the counter and she just starts bawling. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, this is the worst first impression ever. And she comes over to me and she hugs me before she even says a word. And she goes, you don't know this, but I was your court reporter that day that you had to go to trial. And I felt so bad for you that day. And I was like, oh my God. And it was, you know, we're instantly like lifelong friends. But I was like, what a small world.
That's insane. Today, I was getting the car to... And like the news was on, I was like, nah, I can't today.
No. Nope.
Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Yep, there you go.
I can't do it today.
Yeah.
I have to listen to the Dolly Rots instead.
you know, I posted this, you know, yet another one of those, woman who voted for Trump, her husband gets deported and she regrets it. And yeah. I just wrote, this Twilight Zone episode is boring and it's on TV too much.
Yeah.
I'm tired of that news story. I do, to a certain extent, care because I don't think that needs to be happening as much as it is, but...
Did you see the letter that woman wrote to Pat and was like, "You, why do you care? You have great health care. Oh, you're wealthy."
Because I'm a human being.
Pat said, "I have this thing called empathy. It's this weird thing."
Yeah. We all are a piece of our society. We are held together by the fabric of each other. I don't know. But that said, like, come on, man. I mean, you know, I'm from Portland, and every time there's a protest, some dingbats will go, you know, kick in the window of a car.
Yeah, and that's all you see. And
it's just like, man, why? Yeah. You know, it's the perfect thing of, this will make me feel good right now, and that's all that matters.
Yeah, and I gotta I have to defend you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like the people that, you know, I have conservative friends like, don't ask me to defend Ann Coulter. Don't.
Sure.
Yeah, it's like, I'm not going to defend.
No.
I'm not going to defend that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it is true. It's like, wait, this affected me now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, good times.
Good times. You know who has the answer? Doug.
Doug has the answer. You should just party.
Just
neglect your children.
Middle-aged, a gray ponytail is the answer.
Yeah. Well, he actually had like a nice haircut. He was obviously a wealthy man, but like just the head of gray hair always got me. Every time I saw him, where it's just like, when you see someone with that much gray hair, that's just like, not only, and not sad plowed, not plowed like, you don't know.
Yeah.
I'm just happy and completely out of it. We got off the boat, and they put us in a van and drove us back to our various hotels. And they were we were at as nice a hotel as theirs on the beach and everything, mm-hmm. but theirs was far more ostentatious.
Right,
theirs looked
like
a James Bond villain's house, all, you know, modernistic silver everywhere. Yeah. And, he's, you know, there's a party tonight. Look, and there's like signs on the, you know, put up that's just like, tonight, DJ Sugar. And he's like, oh, DJ Sugar. We got to go. DJ Sugar. And like, I don't know. No one knows who that is. Come on. Oh, you guys coming? I could get changed. We're going to go see DJ Sugar. And this guy has had like 7 rum runners. He's going to go to his room and fall asleep on his face.
Right.
And then wake up at 3 a.m. with just the driest mouth and just a tongue made of leather. Are we going to go to DJ Sugar? Like, go to bed, Doug.
He's the grown-up version of when the Deltas went into the bar. Otis, my man!
My man!
If he sees everyone DJ Sugar, like, DJ Sugar! I just love fun. You're an assassin!
Fucking assassin.
So then I eventually get the money back, and then the DA calls me, and they're like, you can come pick up your money. And I was like, what happened to that guy? And they're like, he got like probation, and I fucking lost it. And I was like, you're telling me he robbed me at – because part of it was like kidnapping because he moved me from rooms
this. Yeah, that's kidnapping. That's why OJ's in jail.
Yeah, and he got like probation. Maybe – I forget what his house arrest or something absurd where he could come see me that day, and I went crazy. I was like – why the fuck am I not just robbing people? I'm 1,000 times smarter than him. If there's no remorse, the guy said he was going to kill me. You heard me say that on the stand. And they're like, and I was yelling at her to the point she finally just hung up on me because I didn't want any answers. I was just like, this is fucking bullshit. So then I got my money back, and then so I was like, I didn't know what to do in life, and I was screwed. And then my boss came through for me one last time. I think he just knew I needed something, and these new gamblers moved into town, these young kids that were super smart that had built this computer program that would simulate a game. So if the Lakers were playing the Clippers, it would simulate it like 10 million times and then shoot out a number of who would win by what. And these guys were like the smartest dudes in the world.
Wow.
So he got me a job with them. And so they put me back out on the street, but they didn't really know how the street worked.
Right.
They were just smart. So now I'm making a ton of money. So
they're literally smart and not street smart.
Yeah. So, and we were opposite. So I knew how to work the system. So I went from having no money and owing people money to within probably 3 months, I had like 60,000 cash under my bed again, just making so much money. Everything's going
so bizarre.
Everything's going great.
So you're running their bets and placing your own bets.
No, I'm running their bets, but they didn't know how the streets worked. So like, if you're my boss and I went and I bet for you $5,000, mm-hmm. I would call you and say, hey, Dana, I got $5,000 on the Lakers, and you would write that down. But what they didn't know, what they weren't doing was they were like kind of fat dudes, and they loved to go eat fancy restaurants. So they didn't know how the streets work. So they would have me make the bets. Like I would come to your house and you would hand me, you'd say, here's today's figure. We got a busy day. Here's 212,000 or it's going to be a slow day. Here's 118,000. So then I'd go out and I'd bet all the stuff. And then at the end of the day, I'd come home and I'd turn it in and we'd count it out to make sure we were right. But these okay. guys didn't know how to do that. So they were like, oh, we're going to dinner. Just fucking bring it tomorrow. So I would have all the tickets the whole night so I could see all the games that won. So if I bet the Lakers for 5,000 at six different places and the Lakers won, in the middle of the night or in the morning, I would just go cash one of those tickets, put the money back in the figure, and then keep the money that won for myself.
Got it.
Like the bet was never made. So they just didn't understand how that worked. And right. I was like, at this point, I was like, I've been robbed. I've lost every meaningful relationship in my life.
Yeah.
I'm fucking not going to be the only one not rich because everyone around me is rich. I was like, right. I'm making money this time. And then they finally catch on. So they have five runners on the street and they're doing figures. And somehow they figured out that they were off and they set up all the runners. And then, of course, I was the one that fucking came back with the wrong amount of money. So they're like, all of a sudden, my boss this one day, he just says out loud, it's him. And I was like, oh my God. And the room just stopped. And they were like, we set everybody up today. We gave everybody $4,200 extra. And you're the only one that didn't bring back the right amount. And I start crying. And I'm like in a six-person jury. I'm like, because I knew this was it. This is like my dream job. And I had actually been doing comedy at the time. And I'd been saving all my money because I was going to go to New York anyway. So I was like, this is it. And I was like, I need this job. So I put on a show and I'm like, you know, you guys are like my only family. My dad's off. I play the dad card, all that shit. And they gave me my job back. And then, so we got back to work and I tightened it up and I quit pulling scams and everything. But like I said, my bosses were like nerd dudes and they'd never get laid. So they started Skyping with girls in Thailand, trying to teach them English and shit. So then...
What? Nobody in your life... does anything the normal, easy way.
Yeah. So
I want to meet a girl. Well, there's only one way I know how to do it.
So
Skype a dude in Thailand that looks like a woman.
So they
and teach shim English.
So during the summer, we don't work. We don't do baseball. So they're like, and I have this incredible girlfriend at the time, and I had made all this money. I'd saved
in America.
In America.
Speaks English.
But we're flying all over the world. We're just plowing through this money because my bosses told me in the middle of the summer, they're like, we got a new program. We're going to make so much money next year. I'm like, that means I'm going to make money. So then I was like, I'll put New York on hold because I'm in love with this girl. I'll stay in Vegas one more year and make all this money. So I'm like, everything's perfect, but I'm plowing through money as fast as I can. Fly to Barcelona, Paris, anywhere.
Jesus.
So then everything's set to go. So these guys are flying to Thailand to get their girls and bring them back. But
what could go wrong?
And then in the last minute, one of them decides he doesn't want to go. So I'm supposed to house sit the mansion that we work out of while they're gone. And he decides he doesn't want to go. So while they're over in Thailand, he has like a freak out. And he's like bipolar and has a bad back. So he takes all this weird medication. He freaks out in the middle of the night. He calls his mom that lives in Phoenix. And then he eventually hangs up on her, and she keeps calling back. He won't answer. She gets worried. She drives to Phoenix from Vegas to check on her son. When she gets to the mansion, we worked out of this mansion in this like gated community. She gets in the gates. She gets to the mansion. No one will answer the door or anything. She doesn't know what to do. She calls the police. The police come.
Oh, no.
To see about her son. No one will answer the door.
They find 300 computers.
They jump over the back wall. They find him dead in the pool.
Oh.
Then they break down the doors. And then we had a basement, and nobody in Vegas has a basement. They go down these stairs. They find all the computers and TVs. They think we're bookies, confiscate everything in the house.
Because what you're doing is legal.
Yeah, it's legal, but they didn't know
but
that.
They think you're bookies.
But there's $2.3 million in the house in three different safes in like casino chips, cash, and betting tickets. They confiscate all of it.
Oh.
My bosses come back from Thailand. They get to the house.
Do they have girlfriends?
I don't know what happened.
I don't think they come back with girl. I don't know how that story
you know
ends.
I don't think they did, but I never knew because this is what happened. So then they get to the house and the door's like open.
That's what I want to know.
Yeah.
Are these guys happy with those women?
Well, I know they're not with them now, but so then they get to the house.
How is that possible?
And the door is open. So they go inside and Marco's car's still in the driveway. They go inside. They see everything ransacked. They're like, oh shit. They call the police. They say, hey, we got robbed and we think something happened to our friend. And they're like, your friend's dead and we have all your stuff. You might want to bring some lawyers and come meet with us tomorrow. So then a day later, and I never saw these bosses. I never saw them again. I got a phone call. I was like, hey, what's up? How was your trip? And he's like, hey, man, I got to tell you something. I was like, what's up? He's like, Marco's dead. Like, what do you mean Marco's dead? They're like, he's dead. I was like, what happened? They're like, we're going to Costa Rica. And I was like, what do you mean we're going to Costa Rica? They're like,
Thailand
is they're like, we're moving to Costa Rica tomorrow. And I was like, well, what about me? And he's like, it's over. I'm like, what do you mean it's over? He's like, it's over. And he hung up the phone. And they moved because they want to keep gambling.
Right.
And they felt like the heat was on them. So they moved to Costa Rica the next day. And that was it. And they were gone. And I never, and I was just sitting there. And that was my, it was over. And the gambling was over. And I was like, it was just like that. It was over. And they were gone. I didn't talk to him. And I was like, this is the end of the gambling.
Your father, we don't know.
My father lives in Vegas.
Oh, still alive.
Somewhere. I know he lives in Vegas on the south side of Vegas. He's got hep C. He's kind of a reek. There's just no fixing it. So when I tell people, like if I go on a first date and we start talking, I was like, what's your dad? He was like, and then I tell him, but then, but I just, there's no, if he's alive, it can only mean bad for probably everybody, but definitely bad for me. You know, the last thing I told him when I was screaming, I was like, you'll never fucking see your grandkids. You'll never see me get married. You'll never be a part of anything. And I meant that when I was walking out the doors, like, I don't want him to be, you know, I had a great stepdad.
Well, he's toxic. At a certain point, those people, they wreak so much havoc. It starts to just. So the book that you wrote about this.
Yeah, the book is called Free Roll.
Free Roll.
So it has those stories. It has another. It has a lot of other great stories.
Yeah, I spent a week with you. This is the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, there's celebrities banging my girlfriend. I broke into Mike Tyson's house way before The Hangover. There's a lot of good stuff in it. But
yeah, it is. It was one of those things that happened to me twice this year. Once with Kevin Fitzgerald, who I've known for a long time, and then with yourself. Not long later, I just start talking. He's being like, your life is so much more interesting than anybody I've ever met.
Well, that's like, that'll be one of my favorite memories is we're in the green room and I'm telling you these stories. And I'm like, this is so cool that you're listening to all my stories. And then the feature ended a set and we're both like, oh shit, me and you sprinting.
We both had to run out.
It was like a cool moment. I'll always remember of me and you sprinting out of the green room, running through the showroom like, oh shit. Because we were just so into stories. Yeah, so that was pretty.
Shit. He's offstage.
It was a pretty cool moment.
Other podcasts reach for the sky. Dana Goldbaum.
We barely try.
This has been the Dana Gould Hour, brought to you by The Internet. Music by Andy Paley, with Jake Posner behind the board. Produced by Jeff Fox. Graphic design and web production by Spencer Hunt and Segan Friend. Sound editing and post-production by Jalinda Palmer and Joe Napolitano. Hey, if you like the show, why don't you drop us a line at show@danagould.com. Tom Kenny speaking.
I'm a DJ, I'm a DJ, I'm a person, I'm a person. I'm a singer, I love to sing and DJ. Boom! Pizza! Pizza! You want me? Pizza! Boom.